played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff in better audio quality.
Yes. Well, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Are you sure you're recording it on the microphone this time and not on the on-site mic with the laptop?
No, I'm doing it on the Yeti stereo microphone. As you might have heard over the last few months, I think our old microphone, which was a Blue Snowball, which we bought years ago thanks to a listener donation. Thanks, Kenny. It has been retired because I think it had a short, and you were hearing some, as Sean said, snap, crackle, and pop.
Yes.
A little bit, and it was getting worse, and so finally had to be retired, and I decided, you know what? We've done 130 of these motherfuckers. I can splurge now. Let's buy a nicer mic.
Yeah.
So I bought the Blue Yeti microphone. It's big. It's silver. It looks like an old-fashioned, like, radio mic, which is cool. Yeah. I just think it's like, I can already tell it's going to be more fun to record this just because I'm looking at a cooler microphone.
Yeah, I feel like we should be doing some sort of, like, Orson Welles radio play style thing.
Yes, next week we will try to convince you all that aliens are invading the planet.
Exactly.
Exactly. And the upshot, of course, is that it sounds better. Not just that it doesn't have the snap, crackle, and pop, but it has much better sound all around. It has many more audio settings. So we are trying sort of a basic, what's called cardioid setting this week. It's basically what we've been doing before. It is recording in mono, but going kind of bi-directional so you can hear both of us. And I hope it sounds good. If there's any issues with it, let me know. We can keep testing. Obviously, this is the first recording made with this microphone, so I hope it works.
Yeah, because as the box lets us know, while the Blue Yeti only has four settings, it has infinite possibilities. So,
do you want to make fun of the box a little bit?
I think, yeah, it's hey, boxes are what boxes are, but it's, you know, marketing people have to come up with something to say. So yes, it says in like big font on the side, four settings, infinite possibilities. But my favorite is the opposite side of the box, where you just have to be creative because you have four sides of a box and only so much stuff to put on it. So the opposite side just has a bunch of pictures of cartoon Yetis, and then the definition of Yeti, which the number one definition of Yeti is a legendary ape-like creature who roams the Himalayas, also see Abominable Snowman. But the second definition of Yeti, which they are defining now here for the first time, is an incredibly versatile USB microphone found worldwide.
And, you know, it is. It's a good microphone. But it does seem a little like a weird marketing thing. But you know what? I will give them this. That is the most creative, like, tech box I think I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. It does feel like there's some sort of, like, intern who graduated from an art school. Saw, like, what they were doing with the box. Like, no, here. Like, let me handle this.
I have so many Yeti drawings.
Yeah.
I have to use my Yeti drawings. No, I am very excited to have a new mic. It's a long time coming, and hopefully this will serve us well for a long time. It's also got a stand, some actual, like, screws that stabilize it, so I think the audio will be more stable. We're recording on a slightly uneven table, so that helps. But, yeah. So let us know. If there's any feedback on how the podcast sounds this week, please let us know, good or bad. Love to hear it, and I hope it serves us well going forward. The only downside is it's a bigger and heavier mic, so it'll be harder to transport, but I think that's a good problem to have in the grand scheme of things.
It's better than having the problem of, like, having weird audio snaps.
Yes.
Like every 5 seconds.
I'm also going to be more careful with this mic because the Blue Snowball, if you haven't seen it, it's basically a round, like, it's a ball
on like a stand, tripod.
With, like, a tripod. And so I felt like I was just encouraged to just kind of be reckless with that. I would toss it in my backpack, I'd throw it at the back of my car, and just kind of drive around with it like that.
Yeah, it was that kind of, like, object that, especially when you have the tripod folded in, that when you, like, held it by the tripod, it's like one of those things, it's like it's the perfect shape and size. It's like, I just kind of want to hit someone with this. Like, it's just, it's the perfect shape, and it's just like it fits so perfectly in your hand. It's got a nice weight on the ball at the top. It's like, I could just smack someone in the face with this and have a really good time.
It would indeed be fun. But yes, so we are going to be using the Yeti, which would be much harder to hurt someone with. Or the temptation is lower.
Yeah, it's because it's an unwieldy device. Like, it doesn't have a good handhold for you to smash someone in the face with it.
But anyway, this is going to be a big episode this week. One of our first kind of big topic episodes of 2016 about 2016. We've been looking back. This week we're going to look forward. We're going to do our 2016 year in preview for gaming. Maybe in future weeks we'll do something with movies and TV, but I'm frankly not as interested in that, especially because movies in particular are way harder to predict because, like, if you look at, like, my top 10 list any given year, I had heard about probably very few of those movies the year before, like, because they come out late in the year, you're not always sure when they're going to come out, some can surprise you, and video games can do that too, but they have such longer lead times that it's easier. Like, we know Persona 5 is coming this year, stuff like that. Yeah. So, but before we get to that, we have a couple other little, like, mini topics and just stuff to talk about, and sadly, we do have to begin with not one, but two obituaries. This is not our favorite part of doing the podcast, but it comes up. Last week was a really sad week. We lost both David Bowie and Alan Rickman, both at the age of 69, from cancer that they had kept private, so it was a very surprising in both cases. And just two absolute titans who made a huge impact on my life, at least. What would you say, Sean?
Yeah, for me, like, I've always really respected Bowie. I've never been super into his music. I really like it, and I think it's really good, but I've never delved. Like, he's one of those artists that, like, I will listen to a lot of his music, but I've never gone back and done his whole discography, but I'll probably do that now, since, like, obviously I've been thinking about him a lot. Like, the one that hit me really hard was Alan Rickman, because it was just, like, like you said, like, it just came so out of nowhere, and I like him so much because he's got such an on-screen personality, and I've seen so many of his movies. That's like,
yeah,
it's like, it's just, you see, like, that's just one of those ones where you just don't see it coming at all.
Right, and let's go one at a time.
Yeah,
because Bowie was enormously surprising too, because he had, on his 69th birthday, which came 2 days before his death, he released his what became his final album, Black Star.
Hmm.
And I don't know, have you listened to this one yet?
No, I haven't.
And it was funny because I was seeing it in iTunes, you know, every day, and I was like, okay, I just don't have time to listen to it yet, but I'm really excited because I am a huge Bowie fan. I love David Bowie's music. I have not listened to all of it by any means because he had a lot of albums.
Yeah.
But I will say, like, if I were to make a list of my top 10 albums, at least two of his, I think, would be on there, if I'm being honest and not doing, like, the one per artist rule.
Right.
I think the Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and The Spiders from Mars, better known as just Ziggy Stardust, I think is a perfect album. It was on my top 100 stuff when we did that.
Right, yeah.
Which is high praise. It's just stuff overall. Ziggy Stardust made it on there. Perfect album. I also think his experimental album, Low, which is the first of his Berlin trilogy, I just go gaga for. I fucking love that album. But, and there's so much more I could say. It's just, for now, I'll say, you know, so I was really excited to listen to Black Star. And because that had come out and was getting all this acclaim and stuff, that made it extra surprising because he was not a guy past his prime who had been seemingly sick for months and all stuff.
Right.
He was an artist releasing this big album and getting all this acclaim and being kind of in the spotlight again, and then dies. But when you listen to Black Star, and I've listened to it now. I listened to it the day he died. And you look at that and you kind of look at the discussion around it, you realize that dude dropped the mic so hard on life. It's like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Because he got a cancer diagnosis, because now we kind of know it was an 18-month process. Started recording this album, which is unlike anything he's ever done. It's just as innovative as anything else he's ever recorded. It's like this nightmarish jazz hellscape. It's fascinating. And it is as innovative as any other Bowie album. He records that, makes this big, like, avant-garde music video, releases it just before he dies, so all the acclaim doesn't center around him dying.
Right.
Then leaves the world. That is a fucking mic drop for an artist. Yeah,
that's a rock star fucking move right there.
Yes. And as someone said, you know, we talk a lot about rock stars, you know, dying at 27. It's even more rock star to live to 69, have a loving wife and kids,
yeah,
and release all this great art, and then just go, I'm out, one last masterpiece, see ya.
Yeah, to have, like, lived life to the fullest in basically every single conceivable way possible.
Yes. And Black Star, you know, not a lot of, I think people picked up that there were themes of death on it when it was being reviewed initially, but not as at the forefront or seeing it as a personal album as it is. And of course, you can't help but view it through that prism once he has passed.
Yeah.
And when you do, I mean, it is, I don't think it's just empty pathologizing to say, it is an album very conscious of mortality and very fascinating in how it approaches that, because it is not consciously saying goodbye. It's not like the Beatles recording The End and saying, this is the end of our recording career, and then we're dying, but they were breaking up.
Yeah.
It's more subtle than that, and in many ways more moving, and it is just such an incredible last album. And I think in many ways, just because, not because it's like musically summarizing of what he's done, but it is cumulatory in that it is so innovative and experimental and so 100% Bowie. And that is the thing about Bowie, is that there is just literally no one like him. Yeah. There are so many people who have been inspired, just legions of people and of artists who would not exist in their present states without Bowie, but none of them are like Bowie.
Yeah.
And that's the fascinating thing, because Bowie himself wasn't always like Bowie, because he could be, he was a different thing every time he recorded an album. I mean, I listed my top two there, Ziggy Stardust and Low, totally different. My number three would probably be Young Americans, and that is a, as he called it, plastic soul, which was his attempt to do the white guy version of soul music. They're completely different. The only similarity is that is Bowie's voice.
Right.
Which is this incredible, and I realized as I was listening to all his music the day he died, no one sounded like they believed in what they were singing quite as much as David Bowie. And no matter how silly.
Yeah.
Because Ziggy Stardust got some silly fucking songs on there. You know?
Yeah.
The title of the album is Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. It's a silly album. But that dude believed in every word of it, and it's amazing to listen to, and it is passionate, and it is emotional because of that. And just all his music is. But he also, I think relevant to this podcast and this discussion, is he had a huge impact on the world of film. And I think people forget that because they probably just know Labyrinth. And they know Slouch. Labyrinth is a great movie. I think it's, if anything, it's beloved. I think it's a little critically underrated for just how fascinating and Freudian and weird it is.
Yeah.
And that Jim Henson got that thing made, and it's a, technically a kid's movie. It's amazing. But Bowie is amazing in that movie, and his music from that movie, I love. It is some of the cheesiest music he did, but that's the thing. He owned cheese, and when you own it, there's nothing better, right?
Yeah, no, like that magic dance sequence.
Great.
It's one of the cheesiest songs I've probably ever heard, but yeah, no, like he was such an incredibly charismatic figure.
Yes.
Like on screen, and then in his music, like it's just like, yeah, it didn't matter.
No.
Didn't matter what he was saying, almost at some point, like he could say anything and make you believe in it.
Absolutely. And he starred in several other movies beyond just like he did a concert movie for Ziggy Stardust that was great. But in terms of actual like narrative movies, there are several you could seek out. You know, his last performance in a film was in Christopher Nolan's The Prestige. He literally walks into that movie as Nikola Tesla through a field of lightning with his arms outstretched.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot he was in that.
He's awesome in that movie. There's like no one else in history could play Tesla better than Bowie.
Yeah.
You probably play Tesla better than Tesla. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Because Bowie was kind of the same way, where you kind of, half of you thinks he probably came from another planet or from the future or from the past. Who the hell knows?
Yeah.
And he's perfect for that. But the one you should seek out, if you've never seen it, is Nicholas Roeg's The Man Who Fell to Earth. Obviously a term that was invoked a lot in talking about Bowie this week. And if you don't know the movie, that's not surprising. It's actually a fairly obscure film, and it's fairly hard to find now. It was released by Criterion on a gorgeous Blu-ray that I am mad I don't have, because it went out of stock very quickly and now goes for upwards of $250 on eBay. And whoever owns the rights is just sitting on it. You can buy a manufactured on-demand DVD-R on Amazon, and you can get it in standard def on iTunes, and that's about it. Which is too bad, because it is a masterpiece, full stop. If you've never seen it, it's fascinating. It is about a alien, played by Bowie, who falls to Earth. He is looking for water, because his civilization in space needs it. Earth has it. He is trying to develop a way to get a large amount of water off Earth and back to his family. And he is slowly taken in by the just mind-numbing ways we all drug ourselves, literally or figuratively, on Earth as humans, whether through actual drugs or through television or through the work cycle, all these things. It is one of the most pessimistic movies you will ever see, but in many ways one of the most profound. It is fascinating, and no one else could have played that role other than David Bowie, not just because he looks and sounds and acts alien in that movie, but because he also imbues it with a level of humanity that makes it all worth it. It's a very slow movie. It's a very avant-garde movie in some ways, very artistic. But it is beautiful, and you know, Bowie made it what it was. And if you're going to seek out one, because you've probably already seen Labyrinth. If you haven't, see Labyrinth.
Yes.
The cod piece alone.
Yes. Yeah. Don't care who you are. You will swoon for David Bowie in that movie.
The Man Who Fell to Earth is one I would recommend. Fantastic, fantastic movie. So yeah, that's what I would say about Bowie. It just, it came as a surprise, in part because people die, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, and if they die at an old enough age and they've accomplished enough, you know, there's a limited amount of sadness you can have because they lived a full life, and Bowie definitely did. 69 is kind of young, but good God, he lived a full life. But at the same time, he seemed so much bigger than the mortal coil. His legacy was already written. He's one of those guys who just is so much bigger than one person that it's so hard to imagine death, which is a very small and solitary act in some ways. So, very shocking and very sad.
Yeah, no, without a doubt.
Yeah. Want to move on to Alan Rickman?
Sure, yeah.
All right, Alan Rickman, a lot of the same things to say, obviously. Casts a huge shadow. And even though he didn't start working in film until 1989 with Die Hard, in those 26, 27 years, I mean, man, look at the legacy he left. And we could talk, there are like, I feel like three or four main characters we could talk about, and each of those would be enough for a legacy, but he had three or four.
Yeah.
And then all the other little performances.
Yeah.
So where would you want to start with him?
I mean, you have to start with Die Hard, I think. Just because, like, that is...
It's his origin.
It's such an insane thing that, like, you would never think that. You'd never think that watching that movie that's like, oh, this is this guy's, like, first film appearance. And it's a film role where he, like, I think redefines, like, the villain archetype for action movies. That's, like, that Hans Gruber character and the menace that he brings to it. Like, that's the kind of thing that, like, you go back and you watch Die Hard and you listen to us talking about stuff like the Moriarty in the new Sherlock show or, like, some of the Missy stuff at the end of season 8 of Doctor Who and how we've both been frustrated with the very zany villains inspired by the Joker from The Dark Knight. It's like, what I want is for us to go back to basically what Hans Gruber was like, which was that more intelligent, intimidating, sinister sort of villain that he was not necessarily physically imposing, but he would walk into a room and you would be frightened of him, which is what Alan Rickman could do.
And he could also be funny and charming while doing it. And he was a little zany because he's playing a part the whole movie.
Yeah.
He's acting for the FBI, for his men, for everyone. For McClane at one point when he's doing the funny American accent.
Yeah.
He's acting, but he is, as you say, menacing. And it's actually kind of funny. We talk about The Dark Knight being that touchstone. I would say Heath Ledger was probably very inspired by Alan Rickman because it's got some similarities to it, where obviously that's a very different performance, but that idea of someone who's, again, not physically imposing, but they will command a room and they can kind of be off the wall in some ways, but that doesn't take away from the sinister edge. There really had never been anything quite like it until Alan Rickman did it, and it's because you have a guy who, he's breaking the rules because he wasn't part of that paradigm.
Yeah, and it's just like, and it's a villain that you can be intimidated by, but I feel like it's also a villain that you can respect in a way, and it's like he commands that presence that there's almost something where it's like, I'm bummed out at the end of that movie in a way when he dies, even though he's the villain and it's like, you're supposed to cheer and it's an unbelievably fantastic villain death in that movie.
It's so great.
It's so good. But at the same time, it's like, you just like the dude so much, despite the fact that he's doing some pretty bad things. It's like, I don't want to see him go.
Exactly. And it's the perfect foil for John McClane, who is this just normal, everyday guy who's just trying to get by in a terrible situation.
Yeah.
And he's got this kind of everyday villain in some ways, who they're very well matched.
Yeah.
And, you know, Alan Rickman and Hans Gruber set such a shadow over the Die Hard franchise that the sequels either tried to not recreate it at all, like in Die Hard 2, 4, and 5, I would say, where they have really kind of bland, nothing villains, or
Just back up. Die Hard 2, the guy in Die Hard 2, I can't remember the actor's name. He's fucking crazy. Like, the first scene in that movie is him, like, doing yoga naked in his hotel room, okay?
They kind of tried to overcompensate from Alan Rickman. But
let's not call him bland.
No, like, he's not bland.
I don't think he's a great villain. He is not a bland villain.
Definitely not bland, but he's in a very different mode where I don't think they had a clear conception of what he was supposed to be.
No, definitely.
And then in Die Hard 3, they just said, Jeremy Irons, do what Alan Rickman did.
Yeah, like, because he's his younger brother, right?
Yeah.
Simon Gruber.
And Jeremy Irons is really good in that.
Yeah.
But he's giving a performance in the mold set by Alan Rickman. And, yeah, Die Hard would not be the movie it is without him. Someone said this on Twitter, and I think it's so true. You can just imagine John McTiernan, the director of Die Hard, in the casting room when Alan Rickman walked in going, oh, my God, I've been blessed. What?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if Alan Rickman had to audition or not, but if he did, that would be the most exciting audition in the world, just to see him doing that.
Man.
It also does a mean German accent in that movie.
Yeah, it's something that we wouldn't necessarily suspect.
Right.
Yeah.
And a mean American accent when he has to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He's, like, actually very convincing at it,
which
is funny. Yeah, so Alan Rickman, obviously, brilliant in Die Hard. I have to talk about Harry Potter.
Yeah, of course.
You know, whatever your thoughts on Harry Potter, he created one of the most iconic cinematic characters of all time in Severus Snape.
I mean, he makes those movies worth watching to me. Like, because I am not someone who's interested in Harry Potter in the slightest. I do not like anything about the fiction. I don't like anything about the setting or the world. All that stuff I find lame and bland and uninteresting completely. I don't, like, if you can like your stuff, that's cool. I don't like it. But Alan Rickman as Snape, like, holy fucking shit, he is so good in those movies. Like, it doesn't matter that I don't care about anything else that's going on. I care 100% about what's going on with him in that movie.
Yes.
In all those movies.
Absolutely. He is magnetic from moment one to the last moment. And given how much Harry Potter did mean to me and growing up and how much I love that whole universe, you know, that's where my connection to Alan Rickman ultimately is. Mm-hmm. Because he brought this character who was part of my favorite series as a kid to life. And it is one of the areas in the movies that just flat out, and J.K. Rowling would be the first to admit this, surpassed the books.
Yes.
Snape on the page is a really interesting character. Snape in the movies is a all-time classic character. And it's hard to even know what to say. I think the way I define it, though, is there's a moment in the final Harry Potter movie, and that movie worked me over emotionally really fucking hard in a lot of places, but the last 45 minutes of that movie are very emotionally taxing if you're a big fan of the series, but one of the big moments that made it for me is, and made me cry watching that movie, is his big scene at the end of the movie where he's already died, Harry goes into the pensive and kind of sees Snape's memories. And it's a beautifully constructed sequence, but they're very smart to put Alan Rickman at the heart of it. It's his performance. And what it is in that sequence is he's showing you he's taking the curtain back on a performance he has spent 7 movies and 10 years very precisely and carefully calculating and building. And now you're seeing something beneath that, another layer. And when you get to the end of that sequence, and it is his last moment in that series, it's his last moment in Harry Potter as Snape, and Dumbledore asks him, basically, Snape summons his Patronus, which is in the shape of Lily Potter, who he loved, and Dumbledore says, "You still love her?" And he says, "Always." And it kind of fades out. And that's it. That's it for Snape in that series. That's it for Alan Rickman in that series. In the book, though, the scene in the book is written almost identically, and it goes on a little past that. But the difference in impact between the book, where that line goes past, and I thought it was a nice line, but it didn't break me or anything. There are different moments in the book that I found more powerful there, just as on the page. But they chose to do that one in the film and end it there. And, oh, God, I don't know if there's a dry eye in the house in that scene. It's incredible. And with one word, he redefines a 10-year-long performance. I don't know if there are many analogs for that in film history, in part because the Harry Potter series is so unique. But that performance is so unique in that it's very kind of cold and calculated and kept together and precise for 8 movies.
Yeah.
And then it's just a small modulation when he says always. And it's historic, it's classic, it's an iconic moment already. And, you know, there's so much more to that performance. There is the costuming and that awesome hair and the way he just says things and the way he gets laughs sometimes in that series so subtly. I mean, there's this great sequence in the 4th movie where Harry and Ron are in, like, the Great Hall doing studying or something, and Snape just keeps coming by and whacking them with a piece of parchment. Yeah. Fucking awesome. I don't know how that isn't, like, a gif everywhere, but it's a great little scene where it's Alan Rickman just... He's not smiling, but you can tell he's taking pleasure in it.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that he could do as Snape, where he doesn't show a lot of emotion, but it's a very emotional performance.
And it's something that it was such an interesting thing for me, and I assume, like, you had the same experience, because those Harry Potter movies started coming out when we were so young that, like, him in The Sorcerer's Stone was easily the first time I ever saw him in a movie. Like, I can't imagine that I would have seen anything else that he was in.
I had seen Galaxy Quest.
Did that come out before? I mean, that must have come out before. Yeah. Maybe I had seen that in the theaters or something. I don't remember. But, like, obviously I, like, had no awareness of who Alan Rickman was. Like, you're just too young to, like, be knowing the names of, like, actors and stuff like that. And so it was something weird where it's like, as those movies start coming out, you know, we're getting older and older, and then I start seeing other movies, and then I, like, see Galaxy Quest a number of different times because that movie's incredible, and, like, start taking notice of, hey, there's that guy who's playing basically the Leonard Nimoy Spock character. He's really good. Then you watch, like, that fucking Robin Hood movie that's a pretty bad movie. He is fucking amazing in that movie. Like, insanely over the top, but Like, again, it's something where even if you don't like anything else about that movie, him in that movie makes that movie worth watching.
Oh, absolutely.
Without a doubt.
Absolutely.
And then you go, and then it's like one day you watch Die Hard, and it's like, then it all clicks into place, and you're like, oh, that's that guy. Like, that's, you work your way backwards almost, at least I did. It's like, and then you come back, and then it's like Prisoner of Azkaban's out, or like Goblet of Fire is out, and sort of thing. You go watch it in the theater, and you see him, it's like, oh, holy shit, it's that guy. Like, it's, and then you see the credits, it's like, it's Alan Rickman. And it's like, it's something where you don't, like, my relationship towards that actor and my relationship towards the Snape character in film, I feel like it's almost like the same thing, where it's like, you don't notice him that much because he's not a very flashy actor. Like, he's not, you know, he's not like Bruce Willis in Die Hard is like a much easier sort of like name to remember coming out of that movie, because that's the kind of performance that is, and that's the kind of like actor it is, that's the kind of movie it is. But like but Hans Gruber and Alan Rickman leave like this deep-seated impression in you, the way that like Snape does. That's like, you don't come out of watching those early Harry Potter movies like thinking about who was that guy playing Snape, like he was amazing. You, like, you're probably thinking about Dumbledore because it's the more like
flashy,
like, performance. Flashy performance, like with like the really deep scenes, like at the end of the movie and stuff like that. Where you're thinking like, oh, who are those kids? Like, they're doing a really good job and stuff like that. But like, it's Alan Rickman as Snape, that is the actual performance that, like, really leaves that mark in you. That, like, the next time you watch the movie, as soon as Snape comes on screen, I feel like you realize, this is kind of, at least for me, it was like, this is kind of the reason I'm watching these movies. Like, this is the reason why I keep on coming back every time this character comes back on screen.
I mean, the Harry Potter series has this incredible cast. It's like a time capsule of great British actors from this period.
Yeah.
And he still stands above all of them,
yeah,
giving probably the best performance in that series. And it's such a good performance. And the thing is, it's a very different performance than Snape is on the page. But it was so good, he is one of two characters J.K. Rowling freely admits influenced the books once the movies came out. And said she couldn't see Snape other than Alan Rickman.
Yeah.
And the other one being Luna Lovegood, if you're wondering. But, you know, and you can, I think you can see that in the books a little bit. And the most important thing is, like, J.K. Rowling has, and Alan Rickman always said that he was the only actor who knew the end of the series from the beginning. She gave him that. And you can see it if you watch the movies. He's doing it, but it's so subtle. It's so organic, you're not going to know it. Like, one of my favorite moments in that series is in the third one, Prisoner of Azkaban, which is my favorite of those movies. Snape is a big part of that ending because he's trying to catch Sirius Black and all that stuff. And when Lupin, at the end of that movie, there's the big turn where Lupin becomes a werewolf accidentally. And Sirius goes to fight him. And then Snape wakes up. And Snape is mad at the kids because the kids just fucked him over really bad. But then the werewolf jumps up and Snape turns and puts his arms out in front of the kids, like protecting them. That is something the books never got across about Snape, even though I think it's supposed to be true, which is that he's a dick to people, but he would die for these kids.
Yes. No,
he is that kind of guy. And Alan Rickman gets that with a gesture that's so smooth it looks improvised.
Yeah, and it's something where it's like, I feel like your relationship towards the character changes so much as you age. Like, even going back and watching the early movies again, is that it's like, because when you're a kid, like, his performance, because he kind of leverages that aspect of him where he, like, kind of got typecast as villains so much after Hans Gruber, that it's like, he can do that performance that just feels like the kind of stereotypical, super cold, menacing adult that, like, when you're a kid, you look at him and it's like, oh yeah, it's just this strict asshole, like, science teacher guy or something. That, like, everyone, when they were, like, 8 years old or something, like, had a teacher or relative or someone in their life that was kind of like that, I feel, with how Snape was towards Harry and the other kids. But then as you get older and you watch it more and more and more, and you, like, and as the character does develop on screen and they pull back the curtain a little bit, you get that window into, and you recognize that he's like the best person there. Like, he is the most responsible. He is like the person willing to go the farthest to do what he believes is the right thing to do. And it's like, and it's the kind of thing that, like, he brings that to his villainous performances as well, which makes, like, the villain characters very convincing. But when he brings it towards this really complex, like, multifaceted developing character in those movies that develops across all of them and has this really rich, complex history, that's, like, where you really get to dig into that side of his performance and see that it's, like, he is, like, to me, he's, like, the hero of those movies in so many ways. And you just don't know it because you're just this kid watching it and you don't know what's going on in his head because you just see the outside of it. But as you get into it more and more, you realize, like, no, like, he is the best person there.
Oh, Harry calling his son Albus Severus in the book Really good moment. In the movie, tearjerker.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it feels even more important in the films for Harry to do that.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, it is an incredible performance. And the other big movie we have to talk about is Galaxy Quest.
Yeah.
Which is an, I feel like it's a movie everyone loves and is still somehow slightly underrated because it is such a good movie.
Yeah.
I just watched it again a couple months ago. And if you haven't seen Galaxy Quest, it is this Star Trek parody that I would say is almost like maybe one of the like Edgar Wright Cornetto trilogy movies in that it starts as a parody of something and then becomes the thing itself.
Yeah.
Like it starts as a Star Trek riff, but it ultimately is just better than most Star Trek movies. It's a great Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
And also a film about fandom and all these other things and fame. And Alan Rickman plays, I think, the most memorable character in that movie in a lot of ways. Yeah. The guy who is, he's kind of the Spock riff in that he has the weird head and all that.
He's got his catchphrase and everything.
Yes. Yeah. By Grabthar's hammer, you shall be avenged. And he really hates the William Shatner knockoff, which is Tim Allen.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's very bitter, but over the course of the movie, he has to kind of come to believe in this crazy world that the characters find themselves in. And it culminates in another very emotional moment in Alan Rickman's career when this alien he's made friends with dies and he starts reciting the entire By Grabthar's Hammer oath.
Yeah.
And it is simultaneously silly and heartbreaking.
Yeah. Because it's like he, because again, it's something where he is not the main character in that movie, but I feel like he is so, to me, the emotional core of that movie, because the whole thing about that movie and what makes that movie really fun and rewarding to watch, especially if you are a Star Trek fan, is that at the top of the movie, it seems like the movie is just going to be about poking fun at like the fan cultures and how like extreme it is, and like the contrast between the fans' perception of this franchise and like the actors' perception, the people who have worked on it, who obviously like they like don't see it as this sort of almost like religious artifact that the fans do. But then, and so you think like, oh, that's going to be the whole movie, and it's just going to keep on poking jokes at that, and it's going to be maybe kind of funny, and then you go home. But it's with the development of the Alan Rickman character in particular, and like the rest of the movie does this as well. But it's like with him, I feel like you can so clearly feel the change of that movie, where he starts at the beginning as this like actor who is this classically trained like Shakespearean actor who's like been in like all these plays and stuff. He played Henry V and all this, and he's just does not want to do this. His legacy is completely tied to this character and this franchise to which he has like no respect and he doesn't care about. It was just something he did to pay the checks like back in the 70s or something. And it's the only thing about him that the public cares about anymore. And it's a funny performance because it's so dry and witty. But then it's also the heart of the movie because it's his character that changes the most, to where he is the person who has to recognize most fully how much power there really is in that character he played and in that franchise he was in, and how much it really does matter to those people and how important it actually is. And as someone who is a fan of a lot of those things, like Star Trek and Star Wars and Doctor Who and Persona and all these things that other people might find really frivolous, I think that movie and Alan Rickman's performance so perfectly captures why like those things do matter, like why that kind of popular art is really important, because it does give people something to sort of latch onto who don't maybe find it in religion or don't find it in like science or in like this or that or this other thing, but they do find it in these ideas and in these characters and these themes and plots and stories. And that is as legitimate as it is in anything else. That is as legitimate as it would be in any religion you might find or any field of study or anything like that. Like that hope and that power and that just something that people can believe in and use to sort of fuel the changes in themselves is that important and that powerful. And it's like, it's that movie is all about that. And it's that character's transformation across that movie that gets that across in the most powerful fashion for me.
It's a brilliant, profound film. And he is the crux of it. And yeah, it is amazing just through this conversation how many brilliant and profound works he was the crux of.
Yeah. And it's also like weird when you think about that came out before Harry Potter. And then, like, so, like, he's playing that character, and then he kind of, in this way, became that actor being attached to, like, a fantasy genre franchise that's, like, for, like, particularly now for, like, all the people growing up, is easily going to be his most iconic performance, is going to be a Snape.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's what hit it for me, what made me especially sad the day this happened, is I hear about these deaths on Twitter now, and it's become, Twitter becomes very anxiety prone to me, where I'm looking through, and if I see someone's name repeated more than once, I'm worried they're dead, because it seems like it happens all the time.
Yeah.
And with Alan Rickman, though, I follow at least one Snape parody account, And so I see that dude's face every day on Twitter. And that's one of the people I saw tweeting about it. And it's like, and then I started thinking about all the other places Snape's face is online. And he's a meme, a beloved meme, and he's everywhere. Yeah. And you just see these things all the time. And it's like, yeah, it's tough to be more iconic than that. And it's that's the surreal thing about a celebrity death like this, is that he is gone, and that is sad. But what's eerie about it and what is transcendental about it is these people are so eternal.
Yeah.
You know, Bowie is gone. He's cremated. His ashes are scattered. But he's not gone anywhere. His music is on my laptop. It's in the ether. It's everywhere. Yeah. And Alan Rickman's performance isn't going anywhere. My Harry Potter Blu-rays have it forever. And we all have it in our memories. And Die Hard will always be there. And it will always be discovered by people. And that is what art is. And that's why artists matter to us. And it's this weird thing of defining that line between life and death where these people walk it in such a profound way.
Yeah. And then for me, like, something with, like, the Alan Rickman one just hit me really hard for, like, and I don't know why it's with him. Like, it was almost like Philip Seymour Hoffman, I kind of had a similar reaction when he passed away. That there was just something about it, like, and with Alan Rickman, it was, like, really weird because I was just having a really hard time, like, going to sleep that night. And I was just, like, lying in bed, couldn't go to sleep. I looked at my phone, was, like, just, like, looked at Twitter for a second. It's just, like, can't go to sleep. And then I see, like, a couple of tweets, like you said, like, you do get anxious sometimes when you see this, like, there's probably been dozens of times that I've seen, like, someone, like, imply that, like, the celebrity has died, and then it was, like, a false report or something, and that, like, that stuff can blow up so easily because of social media. So I see that, and, like, I, like, saw it since it, like, it happened, like, it got kind of, like, the information got out then. It was, like, I saw it kind of, like, right when it happened. There were these, like, right when it got out, I was, like, no, there's no way. And then it's like, I just refused to believe it for like 5 to 10 minutes. Like, I just kept on going, like, just looking at other websites of like, there's no fucking way that Alan Rickman is dead. And it was something weird that it's like, I usually don't have that reaction with celebrity deaths. Like, even with like other celebrities that I really love, like, I don't have that. Like, there's no fucking way he's dead. Like, come on. That's ridiculous. And it's something where it's like, I was just thinking, it's like, I don't. It's the same thing with Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's like, I just want to see new performances from this guy. Well, he's so good. Like, I don't want to let that go. I don't want to let that, like, hope go. It's like, I want to see, like, more stuff from him.
And we've made this joke on the podcast a lot, but it was a sincere joke. I always wanted him to be on Doctor Who. And
yeah.
That is the saddest thing for me in this, is just he will never be opposite Peter Capaldi on Doctor Who.
Yeah, like, it's just, and it's just, like, anything. Like, it's like, he could make any movie better. It's yeah. Like, it's just so sad. It's just, and Philip Seymour Hoffman is the exact same way. It's like, you just cast him as fucking anyone in this movie, he will make this movie demonstrably better than it would have been otherwise. I don't care what it is, or who it is. Like, just put him in there. And it's like, there are so few actors or performers or anybody who has that quality to them, and like David Bowie certainly had it as well. It's just like, don't, like, come on, like, fucking seriously, like, he's only 69. That's nowhere near old enough to like let that go.
No,
fuck, it sucks.
And with Alan Rickman, I had no idea he was that old.
Yeah,
not that 69 is old, and part of it, as some people pointed out, is that he's technically was always way too old to play Snape because Snape was supposed to be the same age as Harry's parents, but it didn't matter because he was so good you never thought about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's it. I just kind of thought, because I associated him with Snape, I kind of thought he was younger. And I was like, he was 69. But again, full life. He was with the same woman from the age of 19 to his death.
Yeah.
And they only got married in 2012,
yeah.
Which is kind of badass in its own way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's actual commitment. Like, you know what? There's no possible way we're breaking up now.
Yeah.
It's been 50 fucking years. Let's get married. That's a marriage that actually means something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, man, two amazing people. They will be missed.
Yeah.
And they will be discussed more on this podcast, I am sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you want to move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
All right, we're going to talk about some more frivolous things. I'm just going to go through some stuff that I was going to talk about. First off, so we're going to talk later in this show our 2016 year in preview for games. And speaking of games coming out in the future, I have been moved back to physical media because have you seen Amazon's new promotion?
No, I haven't.
Okay, if you are a Prime member, Amazon will give you 20% off any game pre-order or any game in its first 2 weeks of release for a physical copy. So a $60 game costs $48.
Wow.
Yep. So I already, I already have some, a lot of my PS4 games are already physical, so I'm like, fuck it, in for a penny, in for a pound, and I made my Uncharted 4 pre-order and my Gravity Rush pre-order, and just, and it's a permanent promotion now. If you have Amazon Prime, that's permanent. It shows up at checkout. And yeah, so like for that, it's 48. If it's like a 3DS game, which is 40, that goes down to, I think, $31.99. It's a really substantial savings.
That's a big discount.
It's a big discount. And with games costing as much as they do, it's like, I like digital games, but I'd rather save the $12.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so it's a really good promotion. And the only thing I'm sad about right now is that the version of Fire Emblem Fates I want is out of stock. But I could get it for like $20 off. So I've been checking every day. I hope it goes back in stock. Yeah. But anyway, that one I might have to get digitally. But yes, it's pretty cool. It's if you're an Amazon Prime, if you're not an Amazon Prime member, you should be already.
Yeah, like that's a really convincing argument if you aren't yet. Yeah.
I mean, 20%. That's a ton.
Yeah.
On top of they don't charge sales tax.
Yeah.
So like Best Buy does this if you sign up for their Gamers Club or something, and I don't do that. But with Best Buy, you have to like drive to the store and pay your fucking tax and all that shit. Talk to people at Best Buy. Amazon, they just ship it to you. It's not like I'm doing a commercial, but it's like I'm just looking at my pre-orders page, and it's like I am saving a lot of money on games this year.
Yeah.
So, and it's like it's for me, it feels like it's just free money because I just pay for Prime anyway. It was like Prime has so many other benefits. It's totally worth it. But yeah.
Yeah, no, that's really fucking cool.
Yeah. So, yep. If you had not heard of it, and you are or are not a Prime member, definitely worth it. Because as we're going to talk about later, there's a lot of good games coming out this year.
Yeah.
Definitely worth keeping in mind. So, yeah, I am happy about that. Now, what other stuff did I have? A couple of little movie things. I saw the film The Revenant last week with Leonardo DiCaprio. And it's in the news, obviously. It just got a ton of Oscar nominations, all that stuff. Making a lot of money. It actually came in ahead of Star Wars this week.
Oh,
so cool. Crazy. Star Wars had to go down eventually, but finally did. To The Revenant and Ride Along 2. Two very unlikely cohorts in taking down Star Wars. Leonardo DiCaprio art movie, Ride Along 2.
Yeah.
Ride Along, the series that should be awesome because Ice Cube and Kevin Hart are awesome, but isn't.
Yeah.
Which just sadly defines a lot of things that should be awesome, but aren't. Anyway, so I saw The Revenant, and it'll be relevant for a couple other discussions today. Really good movie. I don't love the ending. I'll just say that right now. The last 30 minutes or so, I think, are really messy. It is a historical story, and I don't need historical stories to be, like, true to history all the way through or anything. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you can't do that if you're going to make a good movie sometimes, but this movie goes so off book in the end and is so ludicrous, just out of place for the story it has chosen to tell in that movie. If you don't know the story, it's about this guy played by Leonardo DiCaprio. He's a hunter, hunter-gatherer kind of person in the late 1800s America, kind of frontier area.
Yeah.
Where does it take place? I'm not sure. I'm getting mixed up with Hateful Eight. Hateful Eight takes place in Wyoming. I'm not sure where The Revenant takes place. But he has a Native American son, and that's relevant. And while he is out kind of in the wilderness with his whole kind of hunting party on the frontier, he goes out alone. And he is mauled by a bear in one of the most horrific sequences you will ever see on film. And then he is left for dead by the Tom Hardy character, who also kills his Native American son. And buries Leonardo DiCaprio alive after his bear mauling. And Leonardo DiCaprio, and again, this is a true story, the character Hugh Glass gets himself out of that grave, walks hundreds of miles across the frontier, and finds that dude. It's a great story.
Awesome.
It is an amazing, like, the star of this movie is Emmanuel Lubezki, the cinematographer, Chivo, as you might know him. He is a 2-time Oscar winner. He won 2 years ago for Gravity, last year for Birdman. That is the only guarantee on Oscar night. He is absolutely going to win again for this. It is some of the most, if not just the most outstanding cinematography I have ever seen. It is all done in the wilderness, in actual locations with natural light, and you have never seen anything like it. If there is one movie from the past year you kind of need to see on the big screen, it's Mad Max. But if there are two, it's Mad Max and The Revenant.
Mad Max and The Revenant would be a great title for the next Mad Max movie. Fucking pull a cast Leonardo DiCaprio again.
Tom Hardy's already in it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. Yeah, The Revenant is very good. Leonardo DiCaprio is great. He is probably going to win an Oscar for this, and it will be his first Oscar, which I think will be a little weird when people look back on it, because he's really good in this movie. But it's mostly just kind of a physically demanding performance. It does not show his range as an actor, I would say. But on that level, no one really does gritty quite as well as Leo these days.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because I feel like Leo has some kind of strange, like, complex to him where he just desperately wants to shake his pretty boy image from the 90s.
Yeah.
Even though none of us see him that way anymore.
No, yeah, it's been a long time. Yeah. I think, like, the Departed basically killed that.
Like, yeah, and The Departed was, like, his sixth movie trying to do that.
Yeah.
So, like, it's just, like, even in movies where he's looks handsome and is, like, well-dressed, like The Wolf of Wall Street, there's a scene where, like, you know, a hooker shoves a lit candle up his ass.
Yeah.
So he's always, and this is, like, his most, like, gruff, gritty performance ever. He barely speaks in it. When he does speak, it's mostly in the Native American dialect of that area. So it's a very different kind of performance from him. And it would actually be a very different kind of performance for the Oscars to reward, which is what I find kind of fascinating about that. The whole movie is very, until the end, which I think is overly conventional, it's a very artistic, almost avant-garde in places kind of work about nature and man's relationship to it. And that's what I love about it for the first hour and or two and a half. It's about a three-hour movie. First 2.5 hours is it's just this great kind of tone piece about this guy who gets totally fucked and is kind of trying to find, not even as something as concrete as a reason to live, but kind of a way to go on in this wilderness after all these terrible things have happened to him. There are just these great existential moments. It is a great work visually about man's relationship to nature and to death and to animalism and all these other things. And then I think it's really overly conventional and has a really poorly written last scene. But the last shot is really good, so it recovers for the last shot. But really good movie. If I had seen it in time, it would be on my top 10. I think it would go above Hateful Eight and knock my number 10 film off, and I think that's where it would probably rest. But yeah, really good movie. I definitely recommend it. And yeah, I don't know if there's anything else to say. I'm trying to think. Oh, Tom, I have to make fun of Tom Hardy for a second.
Okay.
Because I like Tom Hardy. He's a good actor.
Yeah.
I would love to meet him and ask him, Tom, what accent do you think you were doing in The Revenant? Not what were you doing. What do you think you were doing? Because it changes every 5 minutes, and it's like, if you thought Bane was gruff and difficult to understand, oh god, I got maybe 60% of his dialogue in The Revenant, and I'm pretty good at catching dialogue through accents.
Yeah.
No, he's just like, he's got a lot of marbles in his mouth, and he's doing some, it's American, but I'm not sure where he's supposed to be from, because he doesn't sound like anyone else in the movie.
Huh.
It's so bizarre. Like, he wants to go to Texas, but he's not from Texas, and either way, it doesn't really sound like a Texas accent, so I can't pinpoint it. But anyway.
Weird.
Speaking of Tom Hardy, I actually went and saw Mad Max again yesterday because it got all those Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that in a second. And so the Denver Film Center, or the C Film Center, as it's now called here in Denver, is playing it right now on 35mm film, which is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
So it's one of my favorite screens in town. It's a really big, great screen with great sound. So I went to see Mad Max there again. Actually dragged my mom to go with it to me, and she thought it was amazing too. Mad Max crosses all boundaries.
Yes.
She did not want to see it. She thought it was amazing. So there you go. If my mom liked Mad Max, you will like Mad Max. Okay? Yeah.
Some people may call it the best movie that came out in 2015.
It absolutely was. It absolutely was. And it just, it's amazing. I hadn't seen it since like June, I think, when I saw it in the theaters the last time. And so just such an amazing movie. It was shot digitally, but still seeing it on 35mm was amazing. It just, like, that movie has such great colors.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things physical film does so much better than digital, I think, is color reproduction and texture. And man, it was like a, because I don't know where they fucking got a print for that movie, but I think it had maybe been shown once or twice, because the only shot signs of wear were around the reel marks. And those had not been cared for because they were really rough. But past that, like, not a mark on that print. Just looked fucking gorgeous. And one of, just, I saw so many more details that I hadn't seen before. It is such a visually rich movie. It is a perfect fucking movie. It is just amazing. It's the fourth time I've seen it. I'm still seeing new layers in that film. Absolutely astounding. And that's a good transition. I want to talk Oscars a little bit.
Okay.
We normally don't do that. Because
we both agree, award shows are fucking stupid.
They are fucking stupid. But I was pleasantly surprised. I think the Oscars were more on point with their nominations this year than they usually are. Are there stupid things? Yes. They hate black people. We all know this. Oscars so white. It's true. You can say it's a systemic problem in Hollywood. It absolutely is. It's also a problem with the Oscars because they had plenty of opportunities to rectify that this year. If for nothing else, Creed. And the fact that Michael B. Jordan isn't in Best Actor and wasn't even really seriously considered, you're stupid. But anyway, because Best Actor is a pretty weak field this year, and you could have fit him in. Or that Samuel L. Jackson from The Hateful Eight isn't in there.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? What are you people doing?
Yeah.
I don't know. Did I say you people? It's not a racist way. You people are old white guys. Anyway, but yeah, I think like the Best Picture list, I have seen all eight of those movies. Six of them should be there. That's a pretty good batting average. The two that shouldn't are The Big Short, which is a bad movie, and I agree with its politics, and I would love to read the book, but I don't think it works as a movie, and that it is in Best Director 2 is a farce, but whatever. That movie is not too good. But The Martian is a good movie. I just don't think it's that good. So I'm not mad about it being there. I just think there are clearly better movies that could have been there. But you know what is there is Mad Max.
Yeah, I mean, because I don't even know what you're talking about. Because it's like, what I see when I see that list is it's like, there's one movie that needs to be there and seven movies that are there because we can't just only have one nomination that would make this look like a dictatorship. Right. If your dictator is going to be Mad Max Fury Road, fucking sign me up.
Yes. No, I mean, Mad Max got 10 nominations, which is the highest of the nominations except for The Revenant. And The Revenant really only has 12 because it's got two actors, Tom Hardy and Leonardo DiCaprio in there. And I love Mad Max. I would not nominate it in any of the acting fields either. So.
Yeah, it's not a movie that needs... No. Like that's just not the kind of movie it is.
Yeah, the performances are great. Charlize Theron in particular is fantastic. I wouldn't put her in the five best actresses of the year. But all those other 10, very deserved. I love that it... I was pretty sure it was going to get director because I just know directors fucking love that movie and respect it. And the Best Director branch is a little more adventurous. But that it got into Picture 2 is so cool. And then all these other awards. And I don't think it is going to win Best Picture.
But it should.
But it should. And but it really could win Best Director. And that's the one that I actually want it to win. Because I actually care way more about that than Best Picture. Because I can see the argument if you liked another movie more. You are wrong if you think there's a bigger directorial accomplishment.
Sure,
that's just objectively true. I'm sorry. And I think four of those five director nominees, I'm really happy they're there. Adam McKay for Big Short is stupid. The other four, really happy they're there. I think they would all be deserving in their own ways, except they're up against George Miller, and no one has ever done anything remotely like what George Miller did with this movie, including George Miller in the past.
Yeah.
And if you don't give him Best Director, that award has no meaning. That is such a huge directorial accomplishment. Just like watching it again, I realized just like the editing, which it should win too.
Yes, yeah.
Like, it is rhythmic. Sometimes you're just going, one, two, three, cut, one, two, three. It's like you're listening to music. It has a metronome going. It's rhythmic. It's amazing. It is such a directorial accomplishment that I'm already prepared to get mad if they give it to someone else and you're just going to be like, well, you're just doing that to try to be cool.
Yeah.
But you know what would be cool? Giving it to the cool movie!
Yeah. Giving it to the best movie that came out this year in, like, so many different ways.
Yes. No. But yeah, so overall, like I said, the Oscar nominees, there's a lot of good stuff in there. Sylvester Stallone got his nomination for Creed. That's awesome. I thought the score category I liked. A lot of the cinematography category is great. A lot of the acting awards... Again, I don't know why they won't nominate black people. It's too bad.
Yeah.
But the white people who are there are really good actors.
Like, I was surprised that, like, because did anyone in Hateful Eight get a...
Just Jennifer Jason
Leigh. That's right, for the best actors. Yeah.
Which, that's a less crowded category this year, but even for supporting actor, like, how can you not nominate at least Samuel L. Jackson or Kurt Russell or Walton Goggins?
Yeah, there's so many incredible performances in Hateful Eight that, like, if you're going to nominate Hateful Eight for anything, it would be director for with Tarantino, it'd be score with Morricone, which they did, and then it would be, like, any of the performances in that movie basically could go up there.
And I think that could work against it, because supporting actor was so crowded that you could just have a split ballot of some people going Jackson, some people going Goggins, some people going Russell, and none of them get enough individual votes to get in. But still, I feel like Samuel L. Jackson alone, and Idris Elba probably should have been there for this movie, Beasts of No Nation. That's too bad. Yeah. But yeah, it's still a good category overall, and I still think it should go till Sylvester Stallone either way. If it doesn't, farce, but whatever. So a lot of stuff. The stupidest omission of the whole show is Aaron Sorkin did not get a nomination for Steve Jobs.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that is such a phenomenal script. And, like, The Big Short got in for script. That is, guys, it's a PowerPoint presentation. It's not a script. Come on. And that's a little silly, but I was glad Michael Fassbender at least got nominated, because that movie flopped so hard and flew so under the radar, which is too bad because it is so good. But anyway, Yeah, and then in terms of award stuff, the Denver Film Critics Society, which I'm a voting member of, we released our awards last week. You can read all about them at jonathanlack.com. Our best picture went to Spotlight. It's a good movie.
Not the best movie that came out this year.
Nope. But best director went to George Miller for Mad Max. Yeah. And that's, again, that's the one I care about.
Yeah.
Best picture is almost incidental because George Miller is the one who needs that fucking award. And so he got it. And we did give supporting actors to Sylvester Stallone. And score went to Ennio Morricone. So a lot of cool winners. Yeah. I was really happy with a lot of the winners. So
yeah, it's just like the thing that gets me is that I feel like you always have... I feel the thing maybe that I said this on the podcast before. But you do always have like... Basically every year or every other year with the Oscars. It's like you have this one movie that came out that year that's like... For like its genre or whatever it is. Like there's something about that movie that's like... This is this movie that came out from this year that like... 50 years from now, there's going to be someone who's, like, starting to, like, get into movies seriously in, like in an academic way and is, like, really interested in film as, like, a medium. And it's, like, when they're looking through, like, what movies came out, like, in the past, it's, like, that movie from this year is the movie that they're going to watch and fall in love with. It's, like, this year, that was Mad Max Fury Road. I feel like it's so obviously Mad Max Fury Road is the movie that's going to live on that came out this year and have this life that's going to, like, go on forever. It's, like... It just feels like how can everyone not see that that's like the future of this movie is that?
Because there's a lot of stuffy people who, if it has a hint of genre to it, don't want to reward it. And the fact that it even got those nominations is probably the victory.
I mean, that it recognizes like that aspect of the Academy Awards is at least changing, but it is something where there have been so many incredible misses for them.
Just think about the most recent huge one, I think, is 2008 and The Dark Knight getting nothing.
Right, yeah.
And winning nothing and being... I mean, that was the best movie of that year. I'm sorry. That is, as you say, that's the one that goes in the history books.
Yeah, that's the one that has the most influence on culture.
Yeah.
That's the one that, like, in the future, when people look back on, like, the era of superhero movies... Like, that's going to be one of the main ones you fucking watch, if not the main one you watch.
Absolutely. And, I mean, that's a year, I think, Slumdog Millionaire won. I'm sorry, you're fucking stretching to not give it to Dark Knight, which they didn't even nominate for picture or director. Yeah. So, yeah, it's... you're really stretching when you're getting to that. But anyway, it's... Yeah, so it's just the fact that it's... You can look at the best picture field, and there's a bunch of great movies, and Mad Max Fury Road. It's pretty easy to be like, you know what? You guys are okay. You did your job this year.
Yeah. You're still racist, but at least you kind of have decent taste in film.
Yes.
Which is an improvement over previous years.
Yes. Very, very interesting. So I just wanted to talk about all that. Let's see. Okay. Last thing I want to talk about before we get to our topic.
Okay.
Witcher 3.
Yes.
Sean, last week on this show, you waxed poetic about The Witcher 3.
Yes. And I'm glad I did, because it seems to have had an influence on you.
It has. And the thing is, you've talked about it on the show several times before. You and I have talked about it in person several times before. But something about the way you talked about it last week, which was 2 weeks ago for us, really moved me. And the very next day, I went and bought the game at Best Buy, because the physical edition of Witcher 3 is fucking awesome. I don't know if... Have you seen it?
No.
It's so cool. I should bring it. It's got... a note from CD Projekt Red thanking you for buying the game. It's got a full fold-out map of the world.
Nice.
It's got a compendium that fills you in on all the characters and backstory if you want to. It's got an actual game manual, and it's got the physical soundtrack.
Oh,
and that's
nice.
That's the standard physical edition. This game is so awesome, the standard physical edition is awesome.
Yeah.
It's got like a slipcase and everything. It's great. Anyway, and it was just a normal $50 game. Yeah, so anyway.
I might have to just get that, even though I already have the game.
Yeah. It's so cool. But anyway, so I started playing Witcher 3, and holy fuck, were you not kidding?
Yeah, right?
That is one of the best anythings I have ever experienced. And I think I'm pretty deep into it. I'm through all the Bloody Baron stuff.
Okay, yeah, so have you gone to Novigrad?
I'm on my way. I'm kind of cleaning up stuff in Velen right now. And realizing I need to come back when I'm a little higher level for certain things.
Yeah,
because that's one thing you did not tell me. That game is fucking hard.
Yeah. I mean, it's something where... For me, like, that game is hard in, like, the beginning. Like the game is hard up through Velen and a bit into Novigrad, or at least it was for me. And then you start, at least, like, I did so, like, because I just did everything in that game.
Right.
That it was, like, you just eventually out-level a lot of the content, which makes it easier.
Okay. Well, anyway, I think I'm on that path. Like, the main story quests are all, like, four levels below me.
Yeah.
But some of the side stuff. Anyway, Yeah, I don't even know where I would start with it, and I hope we can do a fuller episode about it when I'm done with the game.
I would love to.
But, man, I love this game so much that I played it for 2 hours, put it down, picked up my Kindle, and bought the first book from the series. Have you read any of those yet?
I've read about halfway through the first like short story collection. That was like where it came from.
Yeah.
Because I just started reading it in the summer, so I kind of fell off when school started. I need to get back to it.
Yeah, so I'm on that same, it's called The Last Wish.
Yeah.
And I've got one story left to read, and they're so good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's one of the things you realize, is that those stories are so great, and that author's writing style is so good, and it's such a pure and interesting vision, and the games are so faithful to it, but faithful... I think a lot of people think faithful just means you do the same things in the same order. To me, that's not what faithful means.
Yeah.
Like, going back to our Harry Potter discussion, for instance, Alan Rickman as Snape, it's very faithful, but not to the letter, to the spirit. And that's why it's great. And that's why the fans love it. It's the same thing with The Witcher. The Witcher 3 is not adapting literal stories from those books.
Yeah, it's set, like, after all of the books.
Right. Because the books are very much the Ciri saga, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And this kind of takes place a little after a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it is so faithful in tone, in style. Basically what they've done is they've taken an open world game and built it on the structure of a short story collection.
Mm-hmm.
Where whether you are doing a main story quest or a random one-off Witcher contract, you are getting a story with a beginning, middle, and end that interrogates some kind of moral issue through Geralt. And the fascinating things about that first book, and I think it probably changes as the series goes along, is that Geralt is not much of a character.
Yeah.
He's very much a window into other people's stories. And it's fascinating, over that short story collection, he becomes a character. And it's really subtle how the author does it. And there's this great kind of overarching meta-narrative to it that you see. And so in the game, I think Geralt is a very strong character. He's very well-developed. I mean, clearly CD Projekt Red, this is their third at-bat. They know what they're doing with him. But even then, it really is more about the people he encounters and the stories he encounters and what they say about him and about the world. And I think it is just such a unique worldview, because you talked about how dark it is. And it is dark.
Yeah.
But what I think is fascinating is it's not without morality or optimism either.
No, yeah.
It's a very dynamic worldview where things don't ever work out perfect. Nothing. There are a lot of abject sadness, but there's also hope here and there. And I think...
I mean, you can help people.
You can help people.
And other people help people. It's not just you.
Yeah, and that's what I love, is that I very quickly got a feel for Geralt, and I'm glad I'm reading the books, because it feeds my role-playing of the game, where, you know, you're not creating your character in this game, but I feel like you are crafting Geralt along the way, because you can either play him as, I feel like, the character he's supposed to be, or as a dark version of himself.
Yeah.
But the Geralt, as I view him, is a guy who, he's not perfect, but he does try to help. Like, he...
Yeah.
At the very least, what he can do is maybe go around. He's not going to save the world. He's not going to fix everyone's problems. But maybe he can bring hope once in a while to people who need it.
Yeah, it's the kind of guy where he's not going to be able to, like, slay, like, the, like, earth-devouring dragon or whatever.
Right.
But he is the kind of guy that when he is riding down a path on his horse and there is a woman covered in blood screaming on the side of the road, like, someone help me, my husband is being devoured by wolves. He's the guy who stops and says, like, where is he? Like, point, and just goes running off in the woods to go save him. He's that kind of guy.
Right, and he's the guy who will usually take money because pragmatically he needs it to do his job, but once in a while he won't, because maybe you run into some orphans and they need some food, or maybe you talk to someone who really needs the money for themselves and you figure, I can make it elsewhere.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And it's such... There's so much fascinating morality under the surface of every story you do, and I think the Bloody Baron is a fascinating... It's not even my favorite in the game so far, and it's great. I'm not taking anything away from it, but I think one of the things that's fascinating with the Bloody Baron is that it's dark even by the standards of that game, because it is the situation that literally is hopeless, and that's why it is the centerpiece of all the Velen stuff, because the Velen area of the game is very dynamic. There's a lot of places where you do bring hope to people, there's places where you can't, and then at the heart is this kind of corroded heart to the nation that cannot be fixed.
Yeah, because it's also, it's something where... I love that they do so much with, like, the setting of the game and, like, the political situation to fuel a lot of the thematic development of the game. Because it's like, Velen is on the front lines of where Nilfgaard is invading. Because it's like, if you go to the bottom of the Velen area, you go to, like, their frontier, basically. And there's a bunch of, like, Nilfgaardian captains and stuff. And there's something about that where it's like, Velen is this, like, festering cesspool in so many ways of the old world that's, like... cannot stand against either of these sort of like the northern empires that are sort of marshaling under Radovid, that you get into that stuff when you get to Novigrad.
And then like Nilfgaard, who's just slowly marching forward, like conquering everything in their way, like kind of like bringing modernity with them. And it's like Velen is right there, and it's just like this destroyed, sad little area where it's like there's hope, and you can help people, and there are good people there. But like, if there's one area in that game that I would never want to live in, it would be fucking Velen. Yes. I would never want to go there. I would stay way the fuck away from Velen because it is a shithole.
And there's so many smart pacing decisions because you kind of think the first act is in Velen, but there is some time before you get there. So you do see another part of the world before you get there.
Yeah.
I think that's very smart that you see a more hopeful side of the world. Then you go to Velen, and then I assume you get back into something that isn't quite as much.
Yeah, you go back to like civilization with Novigrad, right, and the Skellige Isles. Yeah,
yeah, and I think that's a really interesting tonal choice. And no, it is so great. It might be the most beautiful game I've ever played. I've been considering that because it's the kind of game where I will just I don't use my horse a lot of the time. I just want to walk and just admire places. And I've taken a ton of screenshots. And if you've heard me on this podcast before, that's my favorite thing about the PS4. And that tells you when I love a game, like when I replayed The Last of Us and just got really into photos.
Yeah.
I love that about the share function and doing that with games. And like just the way this game uses light and shadow
and like and weather, color and weather and clouds and like the sunset stuff,
it's all very painterly. Like, yeah, the backgrounds, the skyboxes just look like paintings. They don't really look like rendered graphics.
Yeah.
And even the way the trees sway and stuff, they look like pieces out of a Van Gogh. It's very impressionist. But like it's also very realistic. Like the way they do the weather where the trees are constantly swaying and things like that, games don't ever do that, and I didn't realize that until I played The Witcher, and I'm like, oh, that's what's missing from every other fantasy open world game is the dynamic nature of nature itself.
Yeah.
And like, it's in the kind of thing where when I'm driving to work in the morning and I go past trees, I feel like I'm in The Witcher because it's making me notice things in the real world that I'm not perceptive of. It is, and it's a technically janky game in some ways. It's got some imperfect.
Yeah, and you're playing it now when like they have patched it like to hell and high water, and it's way better now. Like it was really janky when it came out.
No, and it's not bad by any means.
Yeah.
It's just there are definite moments of slowdown or pop in or whatever. But overall, man, it is a technical accomplishment.
Yeah. And you haven't even been to the Skellige Isles yet. Like that area is fucking just jaw-droppingly gorgeous. Every single vista, every single mountaintop is incredible.
It's just like, definitely with Arkham Knight was the first game where I really got the big feeling of next gen.
Yeah.
But Witcher 3 takes it to another level. This is because Arkham Knight is, at the end of the day, it is iterative of a last gen game.
Yeah.
The Witcher 3, I know it's the sequel to other ones, but it is its own thing, and it is so clear you couldn't do anything about it on past gen systems.
Yeah.
And it is just fucking gorgeous. But man, I will have more to say in the future, but I am so in love with this game. And what I will say now is well, I came up with this the other day and I said it on Twitter, and I think it's very true. And it's the highest praise I can give it. I think The Witcher 3 does for open world RPGs the same thing Persona 3 did for JRPGs.
Yeah.
Where you have a bloated, just boring corpse of a genre that is laying out there in the sun rotting, and someone comes in and says, you know what? We can make this work again. And Persona 3 and 4 did it for JRPGs.
Yeah.
And I think The Witcher 3 does it for open world games in that it is an open world. Like, the actual reason why I hadn't played The Witcher 3 yet is not because I didn't believe it was good. It's just I am so fatigued on open world games. I just, even like Fallout 4, I'm never going to play that. It's just, it's too, I've done enough of that. I don't need to do it anymore. And I'm glad that everyone else liked it, and I don't think it's a bad game or anything. It's just, I'm over that. But with Witcher 3, not even a moment's hesitation once I'm in the game, because it is, to me, what an open world game should be, where you're enveloped in a world, but you're not enveloped in shitty minutiae. You're enveloped in actual story and theme and character, and you feel like you are living in this world, and everything you do has purpose, and not, man, I have a lot of collectibles to get.
Yeah, it's not like, because it's like something where I've kind of burned out on Assassin's Creed Syndicate, and I don't think I'll finish it, because it's like, while I really do enjoy that game, there's a certain part of it where it's like, I open up the map, and then it's just like, oh, fuck, it's like, there's like 5 bottles in this district that I haven't found yet, and 100 chests, and like 50 helix glitches, and 5 pressed flowers, and 2 like posters that are on the walls. And it's like, and there's like 3 carriage missions and this fucking like ring, like brawling mission. And then it's like, I have to take over those districts. It's like, oh God, you look at the map and it's like, it's not as bad as something like Watch Dogs. Like Ubisoft has pulled back from that and from like having seen the Assassin's Creed Unity map, Like, I even though I haven't played that game, I know it's way pulled back from what that fucking game did. But it's still, you look at it and you're like, it just looks like work. It just looks like I'm going to have to, like, spend so much time doing this random bullshit. And, like, it's just hard to see, like, the good parts of the game behind all the bullshit. It's like The Witcher 3 is that open world game where everything in it is good. Like, it feels like every single quest line, every single, like, random, like, encounter you run into, every single character in the world feels like there was a personal touch that went into it. And yes. It does not feel like it was made by a machine. It feels like it was made by, like, a single, united, like, creative vision, you know?
And it's not bloated. Like, even I am at a point where I have a lot of stuff on my quest log, but I don't have so much I can't imagine finishing it.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with, like, Fallout 4 or something like that, to me, just at least. Immediately, it's like I get overwhelmed and I'm just lost in it. And this is more like, no, I want to follow it because I really love these characters, and I feel like there is something finite about this world that is manageable.
Yeah.
And I love that about it.
And it's got that thing that I think is kind of like the highest praise I can give to any open world game, whereas like with like Assassin's Creed Syndicate, or even with Fallout 4 in a lot of cases, it was like I would go to a new area, and it was like there was a little bit of excitement about going to this new section of the game where I haven't done anything yet, but then there's also like this pit of dread deep in my stomach of like, there's like so much just stuff I'm going to have to do here. Whereas in The Witcher 3, it was like every time I went to a new town, it was like I was so excited to go to the notice board. And I was like, I have to go right there. I have to find out, like, I have to get, like, the next Witcher contract and the next, like, quest. Like, I want to find the rest of the stuff in this game. I want to, like, find more stuff to do. It's like I was not afraid of going to that notice board and, like, finding a bunch of bullshit.
Just because every line of dialogue, every piece of written text, it has so much voice and character to it. Like, just the way they think of dialects with these people that you meet. And how they talk in different kind of accents and tones. It is such a complete world.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so, yeah, it's just so enveloping and fascinating. And it's a game I kind of feel like I even want to kind of play at my own pace. And I don't feel the need to, like, necessarily binge 5 hours on it, but sometimes I do. But sometimes it's just like, I can play 1 hour tonight and be like, I'm not frustrated with this. I just kind of need to walk away because I had my fill. It's like a good meal, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I will come back tomorrow. I'm excited, but I had my fill for now. I had that last night where I did a really good, like, Witcher contract, and I'm like, I have to put this aside for the moment, but with no anger or anything. This is great. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, damn. Fucking amazing game.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you talked about it as emphatically as you did. This would be on, you know, this is one of the best games we've ever played.
Yeah.
Good God. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm really happy that you got it. And I'm really happy that you're enjoying it as much as you are, because I know that, like, because I have some of that open world fatigue because it has, especially over the past couple of years, it's gotten ridiculous how everything has gone in that direction. But it was like, I definitely saw when I was playing The Witcher 3 of like, this is, especially contrasted to Dragon Age Inquisition, which is a similar game that like, it's like Dragon Age Inquisition is a game that came to like a similar crossroad as The Witcher 3 and like went a long way with it on the same road and then hit like this like fork in the path. And Dragon Age Inquisition went left and became a, like, interesting game, but an overall dull game. Witcher 3 went right and was, like, it feels like it's a genre-redefining game.
Yes.
And it's, like, everything that, like, the Dragon Age Inquisition was not in terms of this fantasy open-world RPG. And so I'm really happy that you are having that same experience, it feels, because it feels like that, like, affirms my perspective on the game.
Well, it's just, I'm having the same feelings that I did, I think, when you first told me and the audience about Persona 4.
Right.
You were saying, I loved JRPGs once. I got sick of them. I feel like there's been nothing interesting. And I delayed playing Persona for that amount of time. And then I finally did, and it got me back into it.
Yeah.
I feel the same way with The Witcher. Not that I'm going to go play a bunch of open world games again, but it got me to love an open world game.
Yeah. And see, like, how they can be good and, like, how, like, we can leverage, like, what video games can be to improve the open world formula and not just go into the, like, climb a tower, expose the 5 different, like, generic mission sets in the area, and then, like, the half a dozen, like, or, like, the half a hundred fucking collectibles in the area, and just, like, go do all that stuff, and then move on to the next section, and do the same thing, and do that 12 times in the game, and then you beat it. It's like, The Witcher 3 is the exact opposite of that.
Yes, absolutely. Just love it to death, and good way to start 2016 with the best game of 2015.
Yep.
We got that in Arkham Knight in the same year.
Yeah.
Holy fuck. There's those two. I mean, there's lots of other good ones. I'm not taking away from those. But those two, to me, are like the holy fuck masterpieces.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway, so let's go ahead and move on and look towards 2016.
Right before we do that, I have one anecdote I want to share of something that it just occurred to me. This is something that happened yesterday when I was driving with my mom because we were doing some stuff with, like, moving stuff out of our old condo place. And we were talking about, like, oh, we need to do some grocery shopping tomorrow. And there's like, okay, we need to go to Costco. There's stuff we need to get at Costco. And then my mom was like, oh, but it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day tomorrow, which is today while we're recording it. And it's like, I wonder if Costco's open. I was like, oh, I'll check. I pulled out my phone. And I just did a simple Google search of, it was like, Costco, Martin Luther King. And it's like, just like auto-completed it, clicked on it. The first link that I saw was a link that just says on Google, is Costco open on Martin Luther King Jr. Day 2016 with a question mark? It's like, okay, I'll just click on this. And the internet is a fascinating place, Jonathan, because upon clicking that link, I thought I was just going to get a yes or no, basically. And that would be the extent of it. But instead, I got taken to this website called savingadvice.com, where I was presented with this small article written by one Amanda Stewart, and I would like to just read it for us here today on the podcast, because I think this is amazing. So this is Costco open on Martin Luther King Jr. Day 2016? The beginning of the year can be a crazy time. Many people are trying to get organized, stay on top of their resolutions, and then remember all the federal holidays. Federal holidays are important to remember because usually the banks, post offices, and stock markets close on these days. Some stores also close. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, the second federal holiday of the year, is on Monday, January 18th. Post offices, the stock market, and most banks will be closed on Monday. However, it has many people wondering whether their favorite stores will be open. Costco, a wholesale retailer, is a favorite shopping spot for many people. With a holiday just around the corner, many people are wondering, is Costco open on Martin Luther King Day? Costco will be open on Martin Luther King Day. Costco closes on a few holidays throughout the year, but Martin Luther King Jr. Day is not one of them. The wholesale retailer will be open regular hours throughout the week of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Costco closes its doors more than most retailers. Unlike Walmart, Costco closes on Easter, Memorial Day, Independence Day, and other holidays. Here is a list of the Costco holiday schedule that lists it out. If you are ever wondering about a specific store's hours of operation, call and ask about the hours. While Costco is open on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, there are some stores that will be closed. So it is a good idea to check the hours of operation on federal holidays. However, rest assured, Costco will be available for all of your needs on Monday, January 18th.
Okay. What's her name?
It's Amanda Stewart.
Amanda. Amanda, bless your heart. I feel so bad for you. I know you didn't choose to write that article. I know you're just some entry-level journalist at a blog trying to make a living. You're probably a freelancer, and you have to do some SEO bullshit. But bless you, you actually wrote, I think, the best article possible for that bullshit SEO question.
It's a three-paragraph essay. It's amazing.
It's, like, thoroughly researched.
Yeah.
It's got, like, a thesis and conclusion.
Exactly. It feels like it follows, like, basic essay writing protocol better than a lot of student essays I wrote back at the university, you know? And it's something where I have read this thing, like, six times now, and I still can't read it without laughing.
It's so amazing. The part where she starts giving, like, advice, like, remember to call your store. Yeah. That is so funny.
God damn it, it's so good. So, yeah, if anyone was curious whether or not Costco is open on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, it is. It very definitively definitely is. I've got about 150 some words here.
But not on Easter.
Yeah, nope, not on Easter.
Unlike Walmart.
Yeah.
My jaw hurts from laughing.
Yeah. It's really good. It's a great article. Like, not even ironic. Like, it's incredible that anyone was able to write a 3-paragraph essay on the subject of whether or not Costco was open on Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
And then it's Costco. I don't know. There's something about
it's
that.
So it is the most insanely specific question that has the simplest answer possible. It's literally just a yes or no question. But, like, she, like, basically defines Martin Luther King Jr. Day. She defines what Costco is. Like, she defines all of her terms in the question.
It's federal holiday.
Yeah. And then she answers the question definitively, and then also provides additional information for you to do your own research on the subject if you are interested on what other stores' policies may or may not be on other federal holidays. It's a, like, complete answer of that question in more ways than you thought you could be answered.
Man, Amanda, you are awesome.
Incredible. Kudos. So yeah, I just wanted to give a round of applause to her in that article, because it's really phenomenal.
Okay. Well, I don't know how we can top that, but let's try. Sean, let's do some 2016 year in preview.
All right.
So, the month of January has mostly gone by, I feel like, for game releases. Couple of interesting ones on the PS4 I haven't picked up yet. That game Tharsis, have you looked at that yet?
No, I haven't.
It's on the PS4. It's this kind of strategy game where you're trying to go to Mars, and I guess it's super difficult.
Hmm.
And, like, you can cannibalize your crewmates for food. And sometimes you have to if you run out of food. I think it's on discount for like $10 on PSN for now until at the end of the month. And I'm going to try to pick that up. But that's already come out. And if you've never played it, Gone Home just came out for consoles, the console for PS4. Edition. And if it goes on sale, I will definitely pick it up because I'd love to play that again. One of the best games ever. Love it.
Yeah, so fantastic. Yeah.
But anyway.
An important detail on Gone Home console edition is that apparently if you get it on the Xbox One version... The Xbox One, you know, it's like that has like that console side like stat tracking thing, and that they apparently made it so that it will track your number of footsteps simulated in Gone Home. So
that's
if you're
awesome.
Curious about how many footsteps you took to complete Gone Home, or you want to do some sort of like Gone Home lowest footstep like record run, that information is now readily available.
I think I know how to do it because when I first played Gone Home, I accidentally did the lowest footstep record run. Remember that?
Yeah.
Basically, if you don't know, you can beat the game right away. It's that kind of game. It's kind of like Myst in that way, and I accidentally kind of did that when I first played the game. Anyway, and then the only other game coming out this month, because I have my whole list I've made, which I've made it dated through some things in May, and then a lot of unscheduled ones, which we'll get to at the end. But I've put on games that I think are just interesting to talk about, and then ones I've highlighted in blue that I plan on playing. So that's the difference. I'm not sure if I'm going to play this game, but on January 22nd, we're getting Mario & Luigi Paper Jam.
Right.
And that one's interesting to me. It's a 3DS game, and it's in the latest in the Mario & Luigi series, which is kind of the follow-up to the Mario RPG stuff. It started with Superstar Saga back in the day on Game Boy Advance. They're really good. I haven't played one in full since Partners in Time, which was number 2. But this one, I think it's like the 5th or something, it's a crossover with Paper Mario.
Yes, which is one of the best Mario games ever made.
Absolutely. If it gets really good reviews, I might pick it up. It looks like it could be good.
Yeah.
Anyway, my 3DS hasn't gotten a lot of love lately, so could do that. Anything else in January we wanted to mention?
Yeah, I'm just going to go down a couple of quick things. Like Amplitude already came out. That was January 5th.
I got that.
Yeah, like
I haven't talked about that yet.
I played the demo of it. It was something where I never played the original Amplitude because it's a sort of it's an old Harmonix franchise from the like pre Guitar Hero and Rock Band days. And it was like the demo was interesting, not quite enough that like it was something I wanted to play right away, but like maybe in the future I'd get
into
it. I
played the whole game.
Well, have
a quick review.
Yeah, give your impressions.
It's good. I will say this: if you're a huge fan of the original Amplitude, what I gather is that it's different enough that you might not love this one because the set list is mostly different. It does not have any like big musical hits. I think the original Amplitude actually coincidentally had David Bowie in it. There's none of that in this one. Mm-hmm. It's all in-house harmonic stuff.
Yeah.
So it's basically electronic music, techno kind of stuff, house music. And I really like that. I think it makes it different as a rhythm game. I think it's fun as a rhythm game.
And it fits the aesthetic of the game really well.
So I'm playing it. I played the whole thing on the intermediate difficulty level, and I think that was perfect. I cannot for the life of me figure out the higher level difficulty levels. I think they're nigh impossible, but maybe you can have more fun with it. But it's not like it suffers at a lower difficulty level. It's just you kind of chill out with it. I don't know if it's worth the full 20 they're asking for it, and I would not be surprised if it becomes a PS Plus game later this year.
Yeah.
So you might want to hold off. But it is good. It's a gorgeous game. It's definitely fun. The co-op mode in it, it's couch co-op, and it's pretty good. I played it with my brother. That's fun. And it's definitely good just pick up and play if you want to do a couple tracks. It's good to kind of relax with. And you know me, I love indie games that mix music and imagery. So I have like one of those at least every year on my top 10 list. So I like that kind of thing.
And it is like something that's really interesting to sort of go back to the pre sort of Guitar Hero days of rhythm games and like open up a window back into that like, oh yeah, this is like how other kinds of rhythm games can be made. Because nowadays it's like you either have the plastic instrument games, which are made a little bit of resurgence last year, or you have like the Hatsune Miku basic model that comes out of Japan that's like, obviously Hatsune Miku and then Persona 4 Dancing All Night is literally just that. But even, like, there's a bunch of other, like, sort of derivative rhythm games that come out of right. Japan that use that basic system.
And, man, Amplitude underlined for me how much better rhythm games are with just a controller.
Yeah.
Like, you get into the music more. I don't know what it is. But, yeah. And I do. It's nice to have a rhythm game where you actually don't know the music. I don't know what it is. It's just, it's different enough that it's kind of fun. You get into the game more in some ways.
Yeah.
But, yeah, anyway. Yeah. So that's Amplitude. So
then a couple of other things. Like, this is a game that I'm sure is amazing from what I've heard, but I'm like, I kind of just don't want to play it because I know it's incredibly depressing, is That Dragon Cancer.
Yeah,
which, like, I'm just going to say it for, like, if the people haven't heard about it and are curious about it, but it's a very, like, narratively focused sort of indie game about a very personal story about cancer and losing a child.
I will absolutely play it sometime this year because I want to do it for top 10 time by the end of the year.
Yeah.
I may have to build myself up.
Yeah, it just seems like something you really have to prepare yourself for because of the subject material.
Whether I end up liking it or not, mad kudos to the people who made it.
Because, yeah, just for doing that. Like,
good God, that must have been hard.
Yeah. Then, on January 26th, The Witness is coming out. This game has been in development for like 5 years or something. It's the next game by Jonathan Blow, who he came out with the indie platformer Braid, which on the Xbox Live Arcade, which... It's like, it's weird to think of this, like, this is going to be basically his second game, because Braid was the game that started, like, the indie game, like, sort of, like, boom, basically, back in, like, 2009, I think, on the Xbox Live Arcade, and sort of, like, exposed, I think, a lot of people like myself to this area of gaming that had previously just been, like, this, like, weird, seedy, like, the dark side of the PC that, like, nobody went into, that's, like, teams of, like, two people making some game that was very experimental. And so this is The Witness is going to be a big sort of puzzle game thing, and it seems like it's going to be very interesting, and it's going to come out on Windows and PC, PS4. I think the Xbox One will probably get a version as well at some point.
Yeah, that's a game that if it gets really good reviews, I will definitely play but I'm not just going to buy it day one.
Yeah, no, me neither, but it's something I'm looking at with curiosity to see how good it's going to be, because it's been a long time since I've played a puzzle game.
Yeah.
It feels like it's about time to get into that, but I think that about sums up January for me.
Yeah, so February is the busiest month of the year so far that I have on the schedule. Just a lot of stuff, and a couple that I'm guaranteed to play. The two that I'm most excited for this month that I already have on pre-order and everything are... this is a re-release, but Gravity Rush Remastered on PS4 comes out February 2nd. And I have that game on Vita, and I really like it, but I've never been able to get into it so much that I've finished it. And I think it's... I love the Vita. It doesn't feel like it's on the right system. No. I would much rather play it on the TV without some of the motion control gimmicks.
Yeah, I agree.
And the remastered version looks like it'll give that. And this is significant because sometime this year, we don't know when, Gravity Rush 2 will be coming out. And I can then just have both of them on PS4, and that'll be nice. And it's an easy $30. They didn't price it full price. So, and again, on Amazon, you can get that for $23 now. So
yeah.
Pretty crazy. I'm definitely looking forward to that. And then the big one of February for me, and we'll go back and do some of the other ones, is Fire Emblem Fates on February 19th. Holy crap, am I excited for this. And I don't know how I'll have time for any other game this whole year, because apparently there's 3 full fucking Fire Emblem campaigns. That's a lot of hours of gameplay. And I am so psyched, and I'm also really worried about my wallet, because I'm not sure how to buy it to get all the stuff. If you don't know, Fire Emblem Fates has 2 main versions, Conquest and Birthright, which are basically... If you've played Fire Emblem The Sacred Stones, it's kind of the same idea in that at a certain point early in the game, the path branches, but it's much more significant than that because you're literally playing one army or the other. So it's a very different game. And then there's a third version that is DLC only called something else. I forget what it's called. But that one kind of unifies the two. So kind of like Sonic Adventure 2, light, dark, and then together, that kind of thing. And you can buy just one or the other. And if you do that, I think you can get the others at a discount. Or there's a special edition package that is currently sold out that gives you all of it, and I hope they offer that digitally, but it's not up for pre-order digitally yet, so I don't know. But anyway, so kind of a complicated release, but Fire Emblem Awakening is one of the best games I've ever played. I just love it, and I think it's one of the best games of the last few years. I think it's the best game on the 3DS, and this is the same team, so it's like, it's hard to be more excited for this. Fire Emblem Fates, those are my two big ones for February, but there are a couple other really interesting ones. The ones I have, at least, Sean. Do you want me to just run through mine?
Yeah, you go ahead.
Okay. XCOM 2 comes out February 5th. I didn't play the first XCOM, but I love this kind of game, so maybe I should jump in on 2, but I know you did, so what's your thoughts?
Yeah, so I played XCOM Enemy Unknown, which was the sort of revival of the franchise that came out, and it came out for basically everything. Like, literally, like, it came out on, like, iOS even at some point. And that game is amazing. Like, and it's a lot like Fire Emblem in a lot of ways, because it's the, when you go into the combat sections of the game, it is that like turn-based tactical, like moving pieces on like tile set kind of thing. And that like the combat was really great, but like the best part about XCOM was how the sort of like tactical strategic combat missions were interlaced with this broader sort of like meta game of managing your resources and your like what you're researching and like who you're hiring and like having to deal with like sending, because you could only send people out on like one mission each time. And so if like South America was being invaded and at the same time the UK was being invaded, you'd have to make a choice like, well, let's like head over to Brazil and do the mission there because I want to like support this sort of like political faction that is supplying the XCOM organization with money and resources and stuff like that. And like risk maybe like making the United Kingdom side not as like, not support me as much because I know like I have enough favor curried with them that they're not going to just like straight up pull out of the project. And there was a lot of like really interesting risk reward things with having to balance all these decisions about like how you're going to move forward and make sure things didn't fall apart on like a global scale, even while you're like going out on all these missions. So that was really great. And XCOM 2 is an interesting thing because at least at launch, it's only going to be a PC game. They're not doing the console releases yet. And I assume at some point it's probably going to come out on console. So like I'm going to have to wait on that for its console release. But the idea of the game sounds really fascinating, that it's basically the aliens have already invaded and won. And so instead of it being you are fighting off an alien invasion force, like in the original XCOM, now it's they are here and we are like a resistance force on Earth trying to defeat the aliens. And so, yeah, it's the same team making it. So I have every faith in this game that it's going to be amazing.
And I'm sure it'll at least come to PS4 at some point. Yeah. I would not be surprised. Yeah. Sounds awesome. The next big one I have, first big PlayStation exclusive of the year, Street Fighter V on February 16th. And I'm increasingly thinking I probably will have to get this game. It's kind of an inconvenient time, but then again, it's Street Fighter, so I don't have to like feel like I have to play 30 hours of it right away.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I've never gotten super into a Street Fighter game, but I don't know. I feel like I kind of want to jump on the bandwagon with this one, especially because you can get games cheaper now from Amazon.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing about the Amazon thing, is it's going to make me play more games this year.
Yeah.
But anyway, Street Fighter V, it's a PlayStation exclusive, and it'll also be on PC. But yeah, I mean, are you thinking about getting it?
Maybe, I don't know. Like I've played quite a bit of Street Fighter II back in the day, but I've never gotten deep into any fighting game, and like Street Fighter II is probably like the deepest I've gotten into. Like, because I played, obviously, those Persona 4 Arena games quite a bit, but that was like more for the story mode stuff than the fighting. So, like, I might, like, I'm thinking about it. It's, if anything, it's almost, like, more of, like, a just fascinating thing that it's this weird third-party exclusive from Capcom for PS4, and it's, like, the fifth Street Fighter game that, it looks really cool.
It looks really cool, and I'm just kind of thinking, I've never really gotten into Street Fighter, but this would be a great moment to do it because it's you're on the ground floor, it's the new one. They've said it'll be supported in the future. They're not planning on doing like Super Street Fighter V. They just want to keep updating this one.
Yeah.
And so it could be a nice moment to get in because I really do like that kind of game. I've just never gotten into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, it'll depend probably on whether or not it gets good reviews. And if you want to get it, because if you want to get it, I think I would so we could play it together.
Sure, yeah.
But because then I would have someone like online or something or, we, you know. But yeah, it definitely, it's an interesting game either way.
And I'm mostly curious to find out like what the sort of supplemental modes are outside of obviously like an arcade mode and a versus mode. Like, I think it's the fighting game space is in an interesting area where you have things like Persona 4 Arena or, like, the new Mortal Kombat games or, like, that, like, Injustice game that's made by the Mortal Kombat team that is playing around with how you do story modes in fighting games and what kind of stories you can tell and how elaborate they can be. And I'm curious to see how Capcom is going to deal with that in Street Fighter V because, obviously, Street Fighter 4 came out a while ago and it was before that sort of, like, movement to explore the, like a more like story-based mode in a fighting game.
Street Fighter 4, I did not play it extensively. It was the first game I ever had on my 3DS.
Right.
Because they had a weird 3D port, and it was the only game out on launch day, and I stupidly bought a 3DS on launch day. And, yeah, rest is history.
Yeah.
Including the part where I sold the game because it wasn't good on 3DS.
I can't imagine that it was.
But, yeah. Anyway, so that's my big experience with Street Fighter. And then at the end of the month, I'm probably not going to play this game, but I find its whole existence fascinating, Far Cry Primal.
Right, yeah.
On February 23rd. It's kind of like Far Cry Blood Dragon, which was the follow-up to Far Cry 3, where it used the same engine but did something totally crazy, in that case like an 80s action movie.
Yeah.
Now in Far Cry Primal, this is a bigger game. It's a standalone release, unlike Blood Dragon, which was kind of at first a DLC and then became a standalone thing, right?
Yeah, but like a smaller scale thing. Like I think it was like $20 or something
right.
like
this
that.
This is a full $60 game, but there's mammoths and it's prehistoric and it's crazy.
Yeah, it's something where like I'm really curious about this game. This is a game that is definitely like a like reviews will make or break whether or not I buy this game, because obviously like I really loved Far Cry 3 and Far Cry 4 because they both won my Game of the Year awards when we gave them out those years. But it feels like Far Cry 4, while it was great, was very similar to Far Cry 3 in like a whole number of different ways. That if like obviously Far Cry Primal will be different just in sort of the setting and not having guns and stuff like that. But at the same time, like I don't know if it's necessarily just like pulling things out of the Far Cry formula will be enough to make me interested to come back again like this soon, because like Far Cry 4 only came out. I mean, I guess like it is, we're at the very beginning of 2016, so like basically last year, because it came out near the end of 2014. And so like, yeah, I'm curious about it. I feel a little bit burned out on Far Cry. So it's like, it's really like, if it gets really good reviews and people say that the new setting and they like, and how they use the new setting is brings enough new to the Far Cry thing that they've done since 3 to make it interesting again, I will definitely play it. Okay. But if it's not, then I will stay away from it. It's not something that like I will play no matter what.
I will probably not play it either way, but I hope if it's it's good and I hope you'll have fun.
Yeah.
That's
like
I
obviously
can't, right. I can't play everything, but it looks like it could be a really fun game. So I hope it lives up to its potential. But that's what I had for February. Did you have anything else?
Let me look here. I think there were a couple of games we did. Here's like a weird thing that, and maybe we should just like talk about this now because it comes up here, is that according to a report by Kotaku, there's not going to be a mainline Assassin's Creed game coming out this year.
I have that on my Who the Fuck Knows category later on.
But what's interesting is that even if that is the case, there will be more Assassin's Creed games coming out this year than any other year, just in their like Assassin's Creed Chronicles sort of like sub-brand that they've developed, where the China game came out last year. And then this year we're getting Russia and India.
What are those games? I can't.
They're like, I did not play the China one. I thought about it because it got decent reviews and seemed kind of interesting. It's like, it seems like it's like a side-scrolling stealth game that I know you didn't play, but there's a game called Mark of the Ninja that the studio Clay developed that came out a couple of years ago that was basically like that, where it's like you're just a side-scrolling thing and you can like climb on walls. And it's really like that game was really good with the stealth because it was very clear on like vision cones and the sound you were making. And it was like you had a lot of information for how you were approaching things and how you could be detected and to sort of minimize those things. And so that game was a lot of fun. And if these Assassin's Creed Chronicles games are as good as that, they might be worth playing. But in February, the Russia one comes out, which is the last one in the trilogy, because on the same day, on February 9th, that the Russia one comes out, they're also releasing an Assassin's Creed Chronicles trilogy pack. So,
yes, I've seen that on Amazon, where you can get games for 20% off.
Yeah. So that
I'm turning into the advertisement skid.
Yeah, you maybe want to pull out of that a little bit. So that's interesting, you know, like we need to talk about Assassin's Creed when it comes up, because it's a fascinating, strange, weird fucking thing.
We will. I have it on, I have categories, don't worry.
Yeah, because the chances of them actually like setting a main Assassin's Creed game in like China or India or Russia seem very low, so at least like exploring those settings a little bit, that's fun. Then also on the same day though, on February 9th, there's another game coming out that I'm very interested in called Firewatch that seems like it is going to be on PC and PS4. And it's the basic pitch of it is that I think it's a game sort of, it's not by Fulbright, which are the people that did Gone Home. They're making another game called Tacoma. But Firewatch is sort of in the style of Gone Home in terms of a sort of like very narrative focused first person kind of exploration game. And it seems like Firewatch has a sort of like classic Hollywood thriller element to the story that they've sort of been coy on, not sort of giving stuff away. But it seems like that's sort of an indie game to be on the lookout for.
I might play the shit out of that if that's good. That sounds like my kind
of like
thing.
Every indication of it seems like it's going to be really good. So if the reviews come out and it's good, like that is a game I will definitely play right away, because that seems really cool. Also, the same day, this is actually really, February 9th, there's a lot of stuff coming out. That Mighty No. 9 game is coming out, which I don't think I will get. I'm not that interested in. But it is like one of the most high-profile sort of Kickstarter games coming out to consoles, and it feels like that Kickstarter was fucking forever ago. Like, I feel like that was like,
well, they've delayed it like three times. It's getting a freaking physical release on everything.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the Wikipedia page and it's got like the most ridiculous release device window here that's on Windows, Mac, Linux, PS3, PS4, PS Vita, 3DS, Wii U, Xbox 360, and Xbox One. I'm kind of surprised that there's not an original Wii version of the game coming out as well.
I don't know if you can release original Wii games anymore, but yeah, that's fascinating.
So Mighty No. 9, that's like another interesting thing. Naruto Shippuden Ultimate Ninja Storm 4, if you want to play a new Naruto game.
See, February is a busy fucking month.
Yeah, and I actually, like, I downloaded the demo for Naruto Shippuden Ultimate Ninja Storm 4 because I like Naruto okay. It's fun. It's got a lot of fun characters. I'm not so into Naruto. I will just buy this game the way like I just like bought Dragon Ball Xenoverse. But I will say, download the demo. That game is fucking gorgeous. Like, it looks really good. Like, it's worth like just playing through the demo just to see
on
that.
On PS4?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And then also on that same day, on February 9th, Unravel is coming out, which is another indie game. That's the game at the EA E3 press conference. They brought out this guy from, I think, like Sweden or something, some Eastern European country. And basically, it seems like it's a very sort of personal game about where you play as this unraveling yarn character that's like sort of like that indie platformer thing with soul and with a little bit of heart.
So it's like a sequel to Yoshi's Woolly World?
It's like a sequel to Yoshi's Woolly World if, like, Yoshi's Woolly World probably has, like, a really sad moment in it, that like, a Disney movie sad moment is what is the read I'm getting on Unravel.
Hey, speaking of Yoshi's Woolly World.
Okay.
I finished that game.
Okay.
And I had it in my top five above Mario Maker.
Yeah.
We can flip those now. Yoshi's Woolly World is great for five worlds, and then the sixth is horrible, and you should just not play it. It's so bad. It's like the platforming just falls the fuck apart, and it's hilarious. I've never seen anything quite like that. It's a great game still. The rest of it is really good, and it's not like it needs a great ending, but I just thought it worth noting.
Yeah.
While we're on it.
Yeah, but Unravel, if you are way into indie platformers, people are still making indie platformers.
Yay.
And then, apparently Rocket League is coming out on Xbox One sometime that month, and if you haven't played Rocket League, you should probably play Rocket League. It's really fun. It's a good multiplayer online sportsy kind of game. That's like a sports game in the sense that it's not a like insane football simulator or something like the Madden games. It's like a, hey, you know how sports are like a really fun like thing to do that's like a fundamentally interesting activity for humans to engage in that we have been engaging with for centuries? Yeah. Like, let's take the basic things about competitive sports that makes it fun to do and like the basic rules of soccer and just do it in video games instead of it being like this weird abstract like top-down perspective where you're running around the field and like every character is like a little dot and stuff like that. It's like, just get in there and control the, because you're playing basically like rocket car soccer. Just control the car, hit the ball into the goal, like pass it to a teammate. Like, that's what makes sports fun. Rocket League is a cool game.
Nice. One other thing for February.
Yep.
On February 27th is when they're re-releasing Pokemon Red, Blue, and Yellow for 3DS.
Ah.
And I'm looking forward to that. But the bigger thing is on that same day, they're releasing the little new 3DS in America in a Pokemon-themed edition. And I'm trying to see if I can get the picture up here. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't.
It is such a beautiful 3DS. I would have no use for it. It's smaller than I want, but I want to buy it. Because the, like, actual, what they give you, the faceplates, are so cool. It's a small picture.
Yeah.
But it's like the original Red Blue cover.
Yeah, it just looks like the original box art. That's cool.
I fucking want that. It's $200 and I shouldn't spend it?
No, you shouldn't. It's really cool.
But it's really cool. Anyway, so if you don't have a new 3DS, that might be one to get.
Yeah.
But they're faceplates, so you can use red or blue, and then you'd have to buy yellow separately. But anyway, I'm looking forward to that. That should be cool to have those again. Anyway, so February, busy fucking month.
Yeah, and if you have a very broad taste in video games, February 9th has a lot of fucking games to offer.
And if there's anything you can say about us on this podcast, we have a weirdly broad taste in video games.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
All right. March, I only have two major ones on my list.
Okay.
And they're actually both for the Wii U. It's a big month for the Wii U. On March 4th is Twilight Princess HD.
Right, yeah.
Which actually just went back in stock on Amazon, and I grabbed a copy because of the discount. And so that, and it comes with the amiibo with the Midna and Wolf Link. So for the same price, so that's nice. But I know it had gone out of stock. It's coming back in and out, so you should check if you want it. But Twilight Princess HD, which has the most awesome Zelda cover art ever, and no one, like, it didn't get publicized, but the actual cover art is fucking awesome. You should look at it anyway. And Twilight Princess is my favorite Zelda cover art anyway. I've never played the game. I just love the cover art.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's Link and the wolf and, like, Midna's there, too.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
I can see it in my mind.
So that's March 4th. And then March 18th, this just got dated. Pokken Tournament for Wii U.
Or, as it is called in Germany, Pokemon Tekken. Where apparently German, like, I mean, it's a weird cultural stereotype that Germans are very literal people. Apparently the Japanese are way into that stereotype because the German release is just Pokemon Tekken. Because it is the Pokemon fighting game from the Tekken people, so.
This could be a really good game. I'm really interested in seeing, like, I'm not guaranteed to buy it, but I really might, especially because March is kind of quiet, and I think it could be fun. It could be what we always wanted Pokemon Stadium to be, and I love Tekken, so Pokken could be cool.
Yes. And it's great. It's a great name.
Yeah, Pokken.
Pokemon Tekken is not enough. Pokken. That's what I want.
Although,
I want to study Pokken. Like, if I was to study a martial art, I would go to the Pokken studio and, like, submit to Pikachu Sensei and learn the art of the Pokemon Fist.
You know, we are going to have to do a big Pokemon episode this year because it is the 20th anniversary. That's why all this stuff is coming out.
Okay.
So maybe around the time Red and Blue come out on 3DS, we can go back and look at those and kind of talk about them again.
Sure, yeah. I'll always talk about the good Pokemon game.
Absolutely. Anything else in March?
Like, a game that I am very curious about that I will probably not play based on Ubisoft's recent track record for these kinds of games. But on March 8th, apparently is going to be the release of Tom Clancy's The Division, the game that feels like that was pushed back like 5 times.
Right. I didn't put it on here because I don't care.
Yeah.
But I understand.
The game of from E3's past, from long ago. But like ever since the Watch Dogs came out and then Rainbow Six Siege came out last year, in 2015, and did not get great reviews, that like I feel like the scales have sort of fallen from my eyes in terms of Ubisoft had a good couple of years there where every single E3, it was like, they started with Watch Dogs where they ended their E3 presentation. It was like, holy shit, what is this game? It looks amazing. It's like Grand Theft Auto with like cool like cyberpunk cell phone powers and shit. And it's like, look at like he causes his car crash. And it's like, this is an incredible like presentation for a new game. And then like a year later or 2 years later, then that's The Division has its presentation. It's like, what the fuck is this game? It's like this open world, like third-person shooter RPG with like the New York has been gassed or something, and you're going in like salvaging it. It's like this game, like look at how that guy takes cover behind that car and the door is open, and when he moves over to where the door is, he shuts the door and then he moves past it. That's fucking cool looking. It's probably going to just be cut out of the game because for whatever reason, but it's a cool tiny detail. The Division will probably be awesome. And then it's delayed like 500 times. Then Rainbow Six Siege was like, look at this first-person shooter where you just destroy everything in the environment. Like, at the end of this multiplayer match, like, the entire house is demolished. It's like, these are awesome presentations. But then, like, Watch Dogs comes out and it's a piece of shit. And then Rainbow Six Siege comes out and seems like that game is really middling. I haven't played it personally. But it's like, definitely has not gotten a really good reception. And then everything I think about the pre-release buzz about The Division is like blaring warning signals about this game is probably not going to be that good. This is probably going to be another Ubisoft open world game. Again, probably stay away. But it might be good. There's always that potential. But yeah.
Yeah.
It's worth highlighting that it is coming up.
It is
a notable release in the year of 2016.
A lot of people will waste a lot of money on it.
Yeah. Although, who knows? Like, I'm most curious if maybe it won't. Like, I'm curious if the Ubisoft stuff has gotten bad enough and there's enough of a fatigue around it. And, like, the Tom Clancy license, I don't think carries as much sort of sway as nearly as much as it did, like, 5 years ago. So I'm curious that this game might not do that well. Word on the street is that it's weirdly similar to Destiny in some ways, which could be a really good thing or a fucking terrible thing.
Yeah, it depends on what parts of Destiny you're similar to.
Yeah. Well, it's not a first-person shooter, so it's not going to be similar to it in one very notable way.
Yes, all right. So let's talk April, unless there's anything else in March.
We can talk about Mario and Sonic at the Rio 2016 Olympic Games. I'm just amazed that
those are still coming out. Yeah.
That they're still making those Mario and Sonic games. That's happening. The new Hitman game is coming out. That's actually something that I might get depending on if it's good, because the Hitman games are games, it's a franchise that I've always wanted to get into.
We haven't,
but I've always found it really impenetrable.
We've haven't talked about the weird pre-release stuff with this game.
Yeah,
where they were going to make you pay $60, and then they wouldn't release they would give you like a chunk of the game at launch, but the rest of it wouldn't come out till later. Then they said, okay, you can pay $60 to start, or you can pay a small chunk, and now it's just going full on episodic.
Yeah, and it seems like it might even be almost like free to play or something, because they canceled all the PS4 digital pre-orders of the game.
Wow.
So like, it seems like they're like trying some weird experimental release strategy that like coming out of E3 was very sort of vague, but it was a sense of like, there's going to be like a decent amount of content when the game comes out, but the main thing was going to be like every week or however long it was going to be, there were going to be like, oh, there's going to be a new level released with like a new target in the level and like new challenges and old levels and stuff, and they're doing a bunch of leaderboard things. And it seemed interesting, and I've always been curious about the Hitman games because they do a sort of stealth sandbox thing that's completely unlike any other franchise. And I got a little bit into Hitman Blood Money when that came out on the Xbox 360, but I think it was just like when I was playing it was the wrong time, and I just couldn't quite get into it, even though it seemed fascinating. So it's like, and then the Hitman Absolution was the last one to come out, but that seemed like they changed so much about what those old Hitman games were that I wasn't interested in it anymore. That's like, I really want to play a game like the old Hitman games, but I feel like I can't go back to the old Hitman games. So I want a new one of those so that I can just like, I really want to give it like a real shot because they seem awesome.
Yeah. I saw the first Hitman movie back in the day.
Yeah.
You
have to say the first Hitman movie. That's sad that we live in a world where you have to say the first Hitman movie. I saw the first movie based on the hit video game franchise of Hitman, not the second one.
All right. April. Let's see. We have a mix of ones I'm interested in and not, but I'll just go through the notable ones I isolated. The first one was Quantum Break on the Xbox One. It's kind of the big Xbox One exclusive of the first half of the year. And I'm not sure what it is, but it's got a cool title.
It seems like it's going to be a third-person shooter with time powers, and there's going to be some sort of like FMV cutscene thing wrapped in that.
It could be cool.
In some capacity. It could be fine.
I don't know if it'll be any good. But
it feels weird because Quantum Break was one of the Xbox One exclusives that they had at the reveal of the console. Like, it was one of like the very, very early ones.
Yeah.
And it's by, I can't remember the studio's name, but it's the original Max Payne studio, and then they did Alan Wake. So it's a good studio. Remedy Entertainment, that's the name of the studio. So it's like, it's got a good pedigree, but at the same time, like, it feels weird that this game has been in development since basically 2012, or like probably before 2012. It was like first sort of unveiled then. And then we kind of have heard almost nothing about the game since that point. And they've like, I think there was like a little bit of a gameplay thing at last year's E3, but like just like a little bit. It just feels like that game, again, it's like one of those things that kind of like with Tom Clancy's The Division, where like the buzz about the game and like the way that it's being marketed feels like it's kind of like warning signals about if this game was really good, I feel like Microsoft would be out there being like, look at this, like we're having, this is our exclusive game that's going to compete with the PS4's exclusive game we'll talk about that's in April. And that, like, you're positioning it there. It's like, it's their first exclusive of this year. And I feel like I have heard fucking nothing about it for years. So yeah, that's a weird thing.
It's one that, the Xbox One has several cool exclusives this year. This is not, I think, one of the ones to be particularly hopeful about. But who knows? Then I have Dark Souls 3 on April 12th. Definitely a big release of the year. It's amazing to me how that franchise, and frankly subgenre when you factor in Bloodborne, has become so popular.
Yeah, that it feels like it's just through sheer force of pure quality and through like unique identity that it's just like, it just jammed its foot in through the door and is like, you are going to fucking pay attention to me, motherfucker. Because like everything about those games, from their like obscurantist narrative mechanics to like the incredible difficulty they have to like just like the kind of offsetting Japanese game design elements of them where it's like, you don't really know what items certain items do, and like you don't really know where to go or how to play them. Like everything about those video games makes it so that like they should only appeal to a very hardcore, tiny audience, and that everyone else should hate them. And somehow, like each new game comes out, it's like it gets more and more popular, until now it's like, for me, I feel like it's almost like the new Call of Duty or something. It's like because if you count there's Demon's Souls, which was really the first one, then Dark Souls, then Dark Souls 2, then Bloodborne, and then Dark Souls 3. It's like the five of those fucking games. It's like, it's crazy how big this franchise has gotten.
Yes. Now, you did not love Dark Souls 2.
No.
And you did love Bloodborne.
Yes.
And I think you were saying the kind of common link was Hidetaki Miyazaki, who is the guy who designs those. Yeah, he was not director. Around for Dark Souls 2.
But he is for Dark Souls 3.
And so are you excited for 3?
I'm curious about it. I feel kind of like with Far Cry Primal, I feel maybe a little bit burned out because, again, Bloodborne just came out last year. It was my second favorite game of that year. And part of the reason why it was because while it kept most of the stuff I really loved about Dark Souls, which was like all those things that make it like very off-putting to the first time you approach the series, it also like changed everything else about it. That like it changed the slow pace of the combat. It took away the shield stuff, which everyone relied on to sort of like baby their way through a lot of the combat, because you just like shield everything and then just wait and then like just strike on the opening. And just like threw that away and says like, no, you can't, like you have to be actively involved in the combat. You have to be dodging things. You can't just block them. It's like they changed the themes. They changed the setting completely. They changed the style completely. All that was awesome. And I feel like it might be hard for me to go back. I can't tell. Like, I'm definitely curious about it. It's another one that's like the reviews will probably, and like the conversation around the game, actually more than the reviews, will dictate whether or not I play it.
I do wonder how much Miyazaki going back to this series is going to innovate, or how much it's just going to be kind of the next Dark Souls, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But it's like, because I'm more interested in not necessarily even Bloodborne 2, but like the next Bloodborne to Bloodborne from Dark Souls. That's like kind of what I'm most curious about.
Light Souls.
Sure, yeah. Like, it's just like become super hopeful and optimistic and bright and cheery, and there's no killing anything anymore.
You know,
there's
that,
no difficulty. It's like the easiest game ever made.
You know that area in Diablo 3 you can get into where it's like Candyland?
Yes, yeah.
Like that?
Yeah, it's Dark basically Souls. Like yeah. That. And it's like that Miyazaki guy, like, he like got married that year or something. It was like, this is like, or his son was born. It's like, I'm just going to make a happy year. This is a happy video game. Not this, like, just grotesque. Just everything in the world is just beating you down, and you can't take a second to like just calm
down. Instead of like tearing monsters and shit apart, you're hitting piñatas and getting candy out of them.
Yeah, that's.
I think that's totally likely.
Yeah, maybe that's the future direction of the series. But like, you know, even though I like Dark Souls 2 has some like really critical flaws to me, I did enjoy like 20 to 30 hours of that game pretty intensely. Like,
I love that sentence.
It's the only kind of thing you can say about video games, basically. But it's almost kind of like Metal Gear Solid 5 to a smaller degree. It was a game that, like, for a lot of it, I very much enjoyed it. But then by the time I got to the end, some of the things about the length of the game and the repetitiveness of the boss encounters and stuff like that weighed on me so heavily that, like, I kind of have a spite towards that game. But Dark Souls 3 doesn't have those issues.
Yeah, but either way, I just love, and I'm not even a fan of these games. They're not for me. But I love that Dark Souls, this whole thing has somehow become a giant tentpole of the year in gaming.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Like, it does seem like there's almost more excitement around it than a Call of Duty. It's not going to sell more, but there's more, like, enthusiasm.
Yeah, that it's like, the people who care about that series really care about that series so much that, like, I'm still surprised. Like, because I don't even think of myself as a fan of that franchise. Because, like, it took me so long to go to it, because I basically played Dark Souls 1 like a month or two before Dark Souls 2 came out. I definitely did not play that when it came out. And so there's something about that where I don't think of myself as a fan, but then it's like, but Dark Souls 1 and Bloodborne are both two of like my favorite games I've ever played. It's like, I think those games are incredible, and there's nothing like them. It's just like, I kind of am a fan. Like, it's a weird, that franchise is strange. It has a strange presence. There's just nothing like it in video games.
Speaking of strange franchises,
yeah.
Also on April 12th is the re-release, or kind of the rebirth, of Ratchet & Clank on PS4. I think this is a remake / reimagining of the very original Ratchet & Clank game.
Yeah.
And the first game I ever got with my PS3 was one of those PS3 Ratchet & Clank games. I got it with the console or something. And I liked it. And if this turns out to be good, like review-wise, I might pick it up. But yeah, I don't know.
I never really got into the Ratchet & Clank games. I mean, I never really... I've played a little bit of some of the PS2 ones, but I've never really gotten into them at all. That's something where...
It feels like they're testing the waters, and if this does well, maybe they'll bring the series back proper.
Yeah, because it does feel like something that is sort of from a bygone era, because we're so far away from that, like, mascot. I mean, because even by the time that came out, that was, like, the third resurgence of the mascot character style of making games. It's like, you had Mario, you had Sonic, then you had, like, Crash, and then you had, like, Sly and Ratchet and Clank and stuff, like, sort of vying for that same position of being this, like, very marketable mascot character. And I'm curious about it, but...
Yeah. It's not like a... You'll see a theme on this is that Sony is in an enviable enough position that I don't think they have any one major tentpole for the year. I mean, they have the big one, but even that is one of several, really.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of cool that they can just kind of drop something like this, and it's just a fun kind of for the fans.
Yeah, because it is cool, like, if you are a fan of those games and of that genre, of that sort of, like, 3D action platformer, like, people just don't make those games anymore. So yeah. I'm sure if you are a big fan of those games, you're probably really happy that they're making more of them, that genre is sort of getting a resurgence these days.
And I totally can be. I wouldn't say, like, I'm a diehard, I always want to play that kind of game, but when it's good, I really do like that. So if this is really good, I'd check it out.
Yeah.
On April 22nd, we have a game that, in terms of my curiosity about the quality of a game, I don't know if there's anything I am more curious about this year than Star Fox Zero on the Wii U.
I am 100% with you on that. Everything about that statement.
Especially because of, again, like the discounts I get on games now on Amazon. I think I will have to buy this regardless of reviews just to check it out. I may even have to just like bring it over to your place so we can talk about it for the podcast.
Yeah.
Because this is one of the first games in a while directed by Shigeru Miyamoto.
Mm-hmm.
He fucking sat down and made this goddamn game. I mean, not on his own, but he made it. Yeah. And it is this kind of fascinating attempt to figure out a interesting use for dual screens with the Wii U. Kind of like on the DS, where I think most Wii U games on the gamepad, the focus hasn't been on using them both at once, but how they augment each other. This, Star Fox Zero, the way it's so hard to describe, and I can't even really conceptualize it, which is why I want to play it. But you are in the cockpit on the gamepad, and you see a third-person view on the TV.
Yeah.
That is either going to be brilliant, or a magnificent disaster.
Yeah, that it feels like it's almost like, if you think about, like, it's almost like a periscope or something on a submarine.
Yeah.
That like yeah, like you have, like, this brief window, or like if, yeah, like a weird first-person, like, turret view almost on the Wii U pad.
It'll be interesting either way. Yeah. But I just don't know if it'll be good.
It's also weird that, like, there's something about that game, like, it's so hearkening back to Star Fox 64 in so many ways that when I look at it, it just looks like Star Fox 64. Yeah. And I'm sure that's not fair, but it's like every single screenshot, every trailer, like that, like, E3 presentation where they announced the game, everything about it, like, I ever saw about it, I look at it and I do a double take and it's like, Is this just Star Fox 64? Are they doing it? Is this the comparison video where you're showing me footage of Star Fox 64 right now? Or is this Star Fox Zero? I fucking legitimately cannot tell at a glance.
It's fascinating because that series is just such in a permanent rut where the first Star Fox for Super NES is really the only game they've ever made because Star Fox 64 is just a remake of that.
Yes.
It's a big remake because it's obviously going from Super NES to N64, but it is just
But the original one was in 3D, so it wasn't like a crazy remake that changed everything about it.
Right. So it's the same game. Then you have, you know, Star Fox 64 was remade on 3DS. It's kind of being remade with Zero, which is more of a reimagining, but it is still, it's got some of the same things.
Yeah.
And then in between, the only they tried to diverge with that Star Fox Adventures game.
God, that game was so bad.
The Zelda-esque dinosaur planet one.
Yeah, where you're Fox running around on this planet with dinosaurs, and you have like this magic staff that you're hitting stuff with.
Yeah, that didn't work.
Yeah,
and that game was fucking
bad.
And then, you know, there was, I think they did a couple where they kind of tried to redo the 64 thing. It didn't work. So they've really only ever made the one game that worked. And I will say, Star Fox 64 / the 3DS remake, it's one of my favorite games ever. I think it is really a phenomenal game. But, yeah, it's weird. I would hope they, and who knows, maybe we're just seeing little snippets and this is an actual rebirth for the series. Who knows? But I think I'm going to have to check it out either way.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's a fascinating game, if anything, especially coming out of Nintendo. Because Star Fox is one of those Nintendo franchises like F-Zero or something that has a sort of iconic presence because they had like a couple of really great games, and then like it sort of lives on through their like smash up series like Super Smash Brothers. But then at the same time, when you actually look at it and you compare it to like Mario or something or Legend of Zelda, you're like, oh yeah, this is like a D-tier Nintendo franchise. It's just like really beloved, but it's not, it doesn't have like the pedigree and the, like the sort of like expansive like list of games that you can get into, like the history of Star Fox games or something.
No,
like, you can play through basically every Star Fox game ever made, except for Adventures, in like an afternoon.
Yeah. And really, with Adventures, that's because you don't want to play it.
Yes. And, I mean, it is a long game. It is way too long.
Right. No. So, yes, that's Star Fox Zero. And then on April 26th, the big one, Uncharted 4, A Thief's End for the PlayStation 4. could wind up being the biggest game of the year. Who knows? It is definitely a series that kind of was just homegrown on PlayStation. First one did well. Second one did better. Third one did better. And now it has somehow become the gargantuan exclusive for the PlayStation 4. Not that the PS4 really even needs a gargantuan exclusive at this point. But good God, this game is going to sell a lot of copies and move a lot of systems. And it's probably going to be really fucking good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's... Because there's two or three levels to it where it's like, there's one that it's the new Uncharted game, and like Uncharted 1 is a good game. Uncharted 2 and 3 are great games that like are a little bit not quite to my taste, but even like I like them enough to like recognize how great they are and I've really enjoyed them when I played them. So it's like getting another one of those, it's like, okay, that's good. Then it's like it's the next Naughty Dog game, which is like awesome. But then it's like even more specifically, it's the next game led by Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley, who are like the sort of the... who were like the leads and the creative voices behind The Last of Us. So it's like not just Naughty Dog, it's like the Last of Us people are headlining the next Uncharted game. And that's like all that seems awesome and fascinating. And then you have Troy Baker in it playing Nolan North's brother, basically.
Yes.
And so that's fun.
And more than any of that, this is a game that it doesn't feel like they're resting on laurels. Everything they've shown from this game looks fucking great. Like, the most recent E3 demo, I talked about this at the time, the action scene they showed off with Drake and Sully in the car trying to get away is one of the best choreographed car chases I've ever seen, and it's a level in a video game.
Yeah.
They have put their best foot forward with every step of the marketing. It seems like a very confident game, and frankly, it's going to be disappointing if it's not the best Uncharted game.
Yeah, definitely. You know?
And I think it's going to be good either way. But yes, this is one that we're both guaranteed to play.
It's one of those where I cannot imagine this game being bad. Like, it might not be the most amazing game ever, but if this was a bad game, I would be fucking amazed if somehow this was a bad game.
I'm really
excited for Uncharted 4.
Absolutely. So that's April for me. Was there anything I missed?
I don't see anything here unless you want to talk about Total War Warhammer.
Nope.
And how they missed a big trick, not just calling it Total Warhammer.
That's disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. May, I only had one, which was Mirror's Edge Catalyst on May 24th, which I really hope this game is good. I never played the original Mirror's Edge, but it feels like this is both sequel and remake, and that they want to make like the Mirror's Edge game they didn't quite pull off the first time. And I think it could be really cool. So that's a big multi-platform game. Could be interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's just, I never played the original Mirror's Edge either, but it is one of those like little EA games that came out around the same time as Dead Space that felt like, hey, EA, this really big publisher, is trying to like do something new and like create different kinds of games that are not necessarily the most popular games out before. Like Mirror's Edge, there was really nothing had ever been made like that before, so it's really cool that they're getting another shot at it. Like I'll probably check it out depending on how the reviews are.
Anything else in May?
Another game coming out in May that I just kind of want to talk about because I have the hardest time remembering about this game is Battleborn, the next game that's going to be by Gearbox, that it is a multiplayer shooter that takes MOBA, like Dota 2 kind of elements of it and incorporates it. The only reason why I kind of want to talk about it is that I have this insane mental block where it is impossible for me, unless I'm just like looking at it here, to remember that Battleborn is that game made by Gearbox. And that Blizzard is making a game that seems almost identical to it
called Overwatch.
And I cannot keep those two games straight in my fucking head. It's one of those just like weird things where it feels like these two different studios completely independently read these like similar market trends and just came to the exact same conclusion at the exact same time and are both making the exact same fucking video game.
I don't know if I've even heard of it. But what is it?
Battleborn.
Okay, I've heard
it's
of it.
It's also like the Battleborn and Overwatch are both like the two most generic fucking titles.
Looking forward to Overwatch just because I will always give Blizzard a chance.
Yeah, but, yeah, yeah. Gearbox definitely does not quite have the
pedigree.
Yeah, the pedigree and the faith in them that I have in Blizzard for sure.
We'll get to Overwatch in a little bit. Then in June, I only have one game and it's not actually dated yet, so who knows if it'll actually come out in June. But we have to talk about it. It's No Man's Sky for the PlayStation 4. It'll also come out on PC, but this is another one of the big PS4 exclusives of the year, the big indie game of the year. If you haven't heard about it, it's this big conceptual game where apparently you can fly in kind of an infinitely generated world do your spaceship stuff, and if they pull it off, this is going to be an amazing game, and even if they don't deliver 100%, I think it's going to be really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tremendously ambitious game because it's not even by... a particularly large team. Like, it's a, like, it's like, because it's not even like, it's a small team, like, by the standards of the history of video games, not by, like, today where right. you've got, like, Ubisoft teams that are thousands of people. This is, like, a dozen something, I think, of the core team of guys and gals working on No Man's Sky. It's something where, yeah, I have kind of have no idea how good the game will actually be, but it sure, like, talks a hell of a game, and the ambition behind it is so fascinating that it will at least be, like, an incredibly interesting game,
yes.
no matter how it turns out. Like, because it seems like it's going to be one of those games where I'm guessing if you can get really into it, you'll be really into it, but it might be sort of hard to sort of get to that level, because it seems like the kind of game that you're going to have to sort of, like, make the fun for yourself, like, decide what you want to do and set, like, goals for yourself instead of being sort of, like, guided by some sort of story or something like that. It just seems like a very self-directed game.
And I do really like this kind of indie game.
Yeah.
So I feel like it could be right up my alley and maybe in that same Proteus vein, but on a much bigger level. So I am looking forward to it. And definitely one of the big question marks of this year is what impact will No Man's Sky have, I feel like.
Yeah, because it's definitely, like, this game has been around the E3 circuit for a while and, yes. like, has made a really big splash basically every time it's been brought out. I mean, fuck, this game was even showed off on Colbert at one point.
Yes.
Like, early, like, right when Colbert came on. Then they had the guy, Sean, who works for that company, who's, like, basically their front man, who's on all those conferences, and he was on fucking Colbert showing this game off, so...
Yeah, crazy.
It's got an interest in the public eye because the idea behind this, like, fully explorable galaxy that's generated by their algorithms that you can just explore and discover things on your own that, like, nobody else playing that game will ever find. That idea and that pitch is so powerful that it definitely, like, has an impact in a broader market that can make that game really appealing to people who don't play a lot of video games.
Absolutely. So, and then the last game I have in this section, which is dated, is on August 23rd, and that's Deus Ex Mankind Divided.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, the last Deus Ex game
was Human Revolution.
People really liked it, right?
Yes, people really liked it, because that was a franchise that, like, because I've never been able to get into the Deus Ex games. I tried the original one, which that's an old first-person shooter that came out, like, 99, 2000, somewhere around there. And then I tried Human Revolution, because that was on PS Plus on the PS3, back when we had the PS3 at the condo. And neither of those games, like, they both seemed really good, but I couldn't quite get into them. But, like, the Deus Ex fan base is pretty rabid, because that first game was really sort of revolutionary in terms of it was one of the very early games that allowed a huge number of possibilities in terms of how you approach the environment and the situations, and you could go completely non-lethal or just shoot everything you run into, and both of those were valid pathways through the game. And then also it has, like, a really cool cyberpunk setting that, like, that attracts a certain kind of person no matter what. Then I think it's the sequel to Deus Ex is apparently really terrible and everyone hates it, and so, like, that basically seems like killed that franchise, that, like, burgeoning franchise for a long time until Human Revolution came out and people seemed to really, really love that game. And, like, I couldn't quite get into it because, like, weirdly enough, my problem with Deus Ex Human Revolution was almost in the fact that you could play the game however you wanted. And it was like, since you can go through the game entirely non-lethally, like, I just kind of felt compelled to do that. Because it's like, well, if you're, like, legitimately going to give me this option and I can just take, like, trank guns and all this stuff, like, no, I don't want to have to go kill people. Like, I'll just do this non-lethally. And as soon as I decided that, it was like, but playing this game non-lethally is not actually that much fun. But now that I've decided to do it non-lethally, as soon as I started shooting people, I felt really bad. And so I just turned the game off. It's like, I can't do this. Like, you need to, like, set it up so that I can feel okay about shooting these people. But I don't. Like, these guys are just, like, security guards hired by this company. I'm not going to shoot this dude in the face with a gun. Like, but I also am not having fun tranking people and sneaking by them. So I sort of put that game away.
Yeah, so we'll see how this one does. I would be shocked if it actually keeps that exact date this far out.
But yeah.
It's kind of funny to see a game dated that far out, but in any case, that's coming out. So let's move on to the next category, which is unscheduled games, of which there are countless.
Yes.
I have them alphabetical. We'll see how many we get through. If nothing else, the second half of this year is going to be fucking madness.
Yeah.
I'll just say that. This could be like the busiest games for years year for games ever. Fucking crazy. So I've got these alphabetically. Bravely Second, End Layer.
Such a great title.
Yeah.
Such a great title.
If you don't know, Bravely Default, it's kind of a Final Fantasy offshoot. Love that game to death. It was on the 3DS. But it had room for improvement, and I hope Bravely Second is even better. It's already out in Japan. It'll come out here in North America sometime this year. I would imagine the summer, but we don't know yet. So there's that. Crackdown 3.
Yeah.
And I didn't play the other Crackdowns, but...
Crackdown 1 was an amazing game. Crackdown 2 was like... is one of the laziest sequels I have ever played because it is literally the same map. Like, they like sort of destroyed elements of the map because it was like this weird mutant invasion thing. But, like, it was literally like if you played Grand Theft Auto 5 and you were in Liberty City again, and it looked the exact same as Liberty City again, but, like, some of the buildings had been toppled over. And that was it. It was like, you have got to be fucking kidding me. You did not make a new city in your new big, like, open world game. That the main fun thing about Crackdown was, like, leaping over buildings and collecting, like, all these, like, orbs that made probably the single most, like, addictive sound effect in video game history. There's something about collecting these agility orbs that, like, it just is like orgasmic every time you picked one up. There's just something about the sound effect that it's like you could not stop picking them up. It was so satisfying. Crackdown 1 is a great game. Crackdown 2 sucks. I have no idea how good Crackdown 3 is going to be.
I would love it if they just used the same map again.
It's like he ported it over to the fucking new generation, made like the HD remake of that map.
I would buy the game. I wouldn't play it. I'm not going to play this game, but I would buy it just to support that level of audacity.
Yeah, just say, like, fuck it. Like, the map in Crackdown 1 is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. Why do we have to make a new one? It's totally fucking serviceable.
All right. Another fascinating indie title this year is Cuphead.
Right, yeah.
This is one where it basically, if nothing else, this is one of the technical achievements of the year, or will be, it looks like, where it looks like an old, like, Fleischer Brothers cartoon or something.
Yeah, or, like, early Disney.
Yeah, and, man, I hope it's... I can't wait to play it. It sounds like it's mostly boss battles and not actually, like, going through levels and platforming, so we'll see how that works.
Which makes sense considering the amount of, like, unique art
yeah.
that they would have to really painstakingly make. That, like, it was sort of really disappointing coming out of that E3 that, like, realizing, oh, that's what the game is. Because your imagination looking at that game is like playing through one of those levels like it was a platformer or something that like
yeah.
But you know, the art style seems really strong.
Yeah, so that's Cuphead. And Sean, feel free to jump in if you have
any. Yeah, go ahead.
Dragon Quest 7 and 8 are coming out for the 3DS. They've been ported to the 3DS in Japan for a while now, but they're finally come out in the US, and I think those are re-releases I'm looking forward to because I've never gotten to Dragon Quest, and these are supposed to be two of the best ones, so
yeah.
Definitely, that could be fun. And then we have, by far, the biggest question mark of 2015, or 2016, including whether it even comes out, and that is Final Fantasy 15.
Yeah.
For the PS4, Xbox One, and PC. And, yeah, this is, I feel like, make it or break it time for Final Fantasy, because unless you're playing their MMOs, which are great, Final Fantasy has had an up and down time where I don't think any of their games have been wastes. I don't think they've been bad. I think they've been up and down.
Well, let's not be crazy. Let's talk about Final Fantasy 8 and 10. Those games suck.
Okay.
I know there are people that love those games. They're just wrong about those games. Okay. They can love what they want.
Anyway,
they're wrong about them.
I was thinking more of like 12, 13 anyway. But yeah, so 15, it's tough to know. There was the demo. The demo seemed kind of inconclusive for people.
Yeah,
where it looked like it had a lot of promising aspects. It seems like Final Fantasy might be going open world, or it might not. It might be going more technically ambitious, but it might not work. We don't know. I feel like everyone on the team of this game sounds like they have really cool things to say, and I've enjoyed hearing the interviews and stuff. I hope the game is good. If not, I think that might be it for Final Fantasy for a while. And yeah, it's a question mark, because I think they'll probably get it out this year, and probably sometime in the summer maybe, or in the fall. And, you know, I think it'll probably sell well, but if this one is, like, kind of middling to bad again, that's going to hurt the brand, maybe irrevocably.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. If it's really good, that would be such a big deal, I feel like.
I really hope it's good. Like, there's something about that game that, looking at it, it just seems so fascinating to me.
Yes.
It's like, there's just something about this weird... It feels like this like new evolution of the style of Final Fantasy that we have been stuck in, like, the Final Fantasy VII basic mode for so long. There's something about this weird, like, J-pop boy band, like, road trip game
that's
couched in, like, the Final Fantasy, like, epic world-ending disaster stuff. That's like, that sounds fucking insane. Like, there's just, like, like audacious in terms of just completely breaking the mold and the style of what they're trying to do, that I'm kind of way into that idea. Like, who knows how it's actually going to play out?
It's one of those games that I will 100% play just because I'm fascinated.
Yeah.
Like, even if it gets bad reviews, I'm not going to cancel my pre-order. I'm going to play that game.
Yeah,
I'm really excited.
Yeah, it's one of those games that, like, no matter what, I want to know, like, I want to understand it firsthand.
Yes.
Like, I want to get my hands on that thing and
absolutely
see what it's like.
And if it doesn't work, there's always 14. You guys can play it. It's really good. Play it. It's good. Anyway.
You can always just go back to Final Fantasy 1, man.
It's good, too. They're all good. There's a lot of good ones. We'll have to do a Final Fantasy episode at some point this year. But anyway, Gears of War 4, which sadly is not called Gears of 4.
Yeah. Again, titles. It seems like it should be so easy, but everyone fucks it up all the time.
Had a super boring E3 preview. Maybe it'll be good.
Yeah, that's
maybe the world has moved past Gears of War. I don't know.
Like, I was really surprised when I was looking at this stuff and saw that Gears of War 4 is projected for 2016, because it's like, we know nothing. I mean, to be fair, it's for, like, the holiday section, but still,
yeah.
I'd be kind of surprised if it actually came out this year. I feel like that's going to get pushed to, like, next spring.
Definitely. It depends on how important Microsoft views it as an asset, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Gravity Rush 2, we mentioned a little earlier. I like that they're making a sequel to that, and I like that it's kind of a PS4 exclusive. So apparently I would not be surprised if that becomes a North America 2017 release. But for now, at least for Japan, they're saying 2016. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, here's one that I totally forgot had been announced until I was looking for this list. Halo Wars 2.
Yeah. Halo Wars 2, motherfucker.
That's gonna be a thing.
Halo Wars 1 is an okay game. That game is totally okay. The campaign is pretty bad. I'll say that. I mean, most strategy campaigns are bad. But I had a lot of fun because that came out. That was the game that came out right like the next year after Halo 3. And so like that was when like me and a bunch of my high school friends were all playing Halo 3 basically daily. And a couple of us moved on to Halo Wars for a little bit. And the 3v3 multiplayer in that game was quite a bit of fun. Okay. If you got a group of people that you could chat with and sort of like coordinate strategies, it was a really well-designed console game on real-time strategy console game that's like, it's something that in the like sort of the beginning of the Xbox 360 years, the people were kind of testing the waters for that. And I felt like Halo Wars was the only one that did it pretty well. And it was also like the last one to even try it. Like, I feel like there's no game has come out since then that has tried like the StarCraft style real-time strategy stuff on consoles.
And I have nothing against this. I just think of all the weird like video game spin-offs you could bring back, Halo Wars is one of the more obscure.
Yeah.
And weird. But maybe it'll be really good. Who knows?
I mean, it ended with the crew of the Spirit of Fire being like cryogenically frozen on their ship and drifting through space. So who knows? Like, I have no idea I presume it's going to continue the story of Halo Wars 1.
The other significant thing about Halo Wars is that it crashed the studio that made it.
Yeah, I mean, although, like, that studio was, like, kind of on its way out by the game ensemble.
So it's a totally different developer for this one.
I've totally forgotten about that. Because Ensemble, they were the old Age of Empires guys before that studio got shut down.
Yeah. All right. Then, just so we can laugh at this, Kingdom Hearts 2.8. Which is their collection. They did 1.5 and 2.5.
You've forgotten. It's called Kingdom Hearts HD 2.8 Final Chapter Prologue. And at least on the Wikipedia page, I've like almost refused to believe that this is actually true. But on the Wikipedia page, the 2.8, the 2 is in Roman numerals.
That's true. No, they're doing that.
It can't be.
It's on the box.
It can't. If you click on the link, it says 2.8 on it here with normal letters. But on the picture they have, it's the Roman numerals. I refuse. That can't be true.
That's what they did for the other ones. 1.5 and
2.5. No, it's not, Jonathan. That's not true.
Yes,
no human being could do that. That's just wrong. It's evil. You can't fucking do that. You can't mix Roman numerals and Arabic numerals. It's impure. It's fucked up. It's not okay. What are they doing? Jonathan, what are they doing?
I don't know. And I think it's a remake of, like, one of the 3DS games, like Dream Drop Distance. Is
this says it has Kingdom Hearts Dream Drop Distance HD, Kingdom Hearts Cross Back Cover, or X Back Cover, however you're supposed to pronounce it, and Kingdom Hearts 0.2 Birth by Sleep - A Fragmentary Passage.
That's like a prequel to the PSP game, I think.
I am just very thankful that there's no Roman numeral for the number 0, so they can't do it for 0.2. Those fucking animals.
All right, let's move on to What
it is a successor to Kingdom Hearts HD 2.5 Remix, in case you were wondering.
Let's move on to what very possibly could be the biggest game of this year, Mass Effect Andromeda.
Oh, fuck, that's coming out this year?
If that comes out this year, I mean, that's what they've been saying. I think it could get pushed. A Mass Effect game, typically they come out in like March after being planned for November, so who knows? Yeah. It is planned, and I will say, this is going to be fascinating, because I think the Mass Effect trilogy, I was looking the other day at my list of my personal favorite games of all time, because I want to remake it, because it's been a couple years, and like republish that, and it goes Persona 3, Persona 4, Mass Effect trilogy. I really do think it's the best, at least American game ever made. I think those are superior.
Yeah.
And this is the next one. And I have ambivalent feelings about it because I don't think there needs to be more Mass Effect as much as I love it. But at the same time, if they can keep that alive and do something great with it, well, you're talking about a sequel to three of the greatest games ever made.
Yeah.
This could be an absolute landmark release. We'll see. And we know nothing about it, so who knows?
I mean, we know it's going to be set in the Andromeda Galaxy, which is a cool idea, because all of the original Mass Effect games were in our galaxy, so Milky Way. So yeah, it could be cool. Like, I'm very excited and hopeful for the game. It's another one of those, kind of like with Gears of War 4, where I would not be particularly surprised if that got pushed back a little bit.
All right, then we have the biggest troll of 2016... in Metroid Prime Federation Force.
Oh, yeah.
Where you are taking the title of literally one of the greatest games ever made in Metroid Prime and making it for your shitty Rocket League ripoff, Metroid Prime Federation Force for 3DS. We all wanted a new Metroid game, but no. You have to give us this.
Yeah.
Nintendo, what the fuck did we ever do to you?
I don't...
You're only punishing the people who actually bought your consoles, not all the people who didn't. Come on.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought that was really funny at their E3 thing, that there was like, we're making more Metroid stuff that's like franchise that you've been waiting for, like a good new Metroid game since all reports suggest that they dropped the ball with Other M. At least, like, Metroid fans fucking despise that game for reasons that looking into it seem very legitimate. And so, Metroid is one of those Nintendo franchises that, like, it's so good. But they so very rarely actually make new Metroid games.
Which is okay on some level, because it means the average quality of the Metroid games is insanely high.
Yeah.
But
at the same time, like, it has been a while since Metroid Prime 3.
Yeah. So, yes. Then I have on here a game called Abduction, which is a kickstarted game by the people who originally did Cyan, which made Myst. And the Myst series. And this is kind of a spiritual sequel to Myst. Kind of like Mighty No. 9 is a spiritual sequel to Mega Man.
Yeah.
And I keep being reminded of this because my little brother, Thomas, kickstarted this. So he's going to get that game. But I'm definitely curious. I think that would be kind of cool to see what the Myst people could do with a Myst-esque game in this day and age. So I'm curious about that game. Myst holds a special place in my heart for reasons that don't really have to do anything with the game. So we'll see if I actually like Abduction when it comes out. But
yeah,
there you go.
Cool.
Overwatch, we've talked about. It was going to come out in March. It got pushed, and we don't know when it's going to come out. But that is the new MOBA-style game from Blizzard. And it'll have a console release, which is why I'm excited.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, you can play it on Xbox and PS4. And I think it could be a ton of fun. It's multiplayer only, but they're only charging $40. And, you know, no one's got style like Blizzard. You know, Blizzard games are just, they are Blizzard games. This could be a lot of fun. And I've heard only good things from the beta, so.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be a pretty good game.
Yeah. And I've never really played a mobile-style thing before, so who knows?
Yeah, like, it's something where it's like, I don't know a whole lot about Overwatch because I can't retain information about it because it's like it and Battleborn just occupy the same, it's just this exact same cell in my brain holds both of that thing, those games simultaneously, and it can't work.
Yes, okay, I'm skipping ahead in the alphabet a little bit because we got to save the best for last.
Yes.
And I have ReCore.
Yeah.
Is that the one being made by the Metroid Prime people?
I don't remember who it's being made by. It's the new Xbox One.
Who's the director?
It's being developed by Comseft and Armature Studios. I don't... Keiji Inafune. So it's some people who have worked on the Metroid Prime stuff. Keiji Inafune was like a classic Capcom dude. He's developed like...
Well, the director's name is specifically what I was looking at, because it's Mark something, right?
Mark Piccini.
Yeah, I think he directed the three Metroid Prime games. So that's
fascinating. He did, yeah.
Yeah. And that studio, Armature, they were developed, they broke off from Nintendo, from Retro, basically, after Metroid Prime 3. But the only major release they've had is Arkham Origins Blackgate.
Yeah.
So they haven't had a lot of work, but ReCore is like their first big statement as a company. It's an Xbox One exclusive. I think this could be really cool. We haven't seen a lot from it.
Yeah, there was that one CG trailer at this year's E3.
So, but I'm excited. I mean, again, you're talking about these guys made one of the greatest games ever, one of the greatest game series ever. They get at least interest, you know? They've earned that. So ReCore could be cool. And it's something where it's like, that feels like an exciting Xbox One exclusive.
Yeah.
Whereas some of the other ones this year feel a little half-baked. This one looks like it could be cool. And then we have The Last Guardian, apparently finally coming out. I won't believe it until the disc is in my hand. But that is the game that was infamously announced alongside the PS3.
Yeah.
Waited the entire lifespan of the PS3, never came out. Waited several years from the PS4, and then was miraculously re-unveiled at E3 last year. And, you know, basically what has come out is that it was finished in development years ago. It did not run right on the PS3 because the PS3 just wouldn't work on it. And basically, the people who made that game have since moved on, and basically Sony helped them, had a team of developers basically tear it apart and rebuild it for the PS4, which is very easy to develop for.
Yeah.
And now we're finally getting it. And this is the same team that made Ico and Shadow of the Colossus. So, could be a classic. Who knows? It could be a mess. But it is definitely going to be one of the big question marks and fascinating points of 2016.
Yeah, without a doubt.
So, and then Sean...
Well, let's wait. I'm going to like go through this really quick and like to pick out a couple of games that you didn't mention. So Doom, the new Doom game is coming out. I have no idea if that game is going to be good or bad. I'm still waiting for the fucking multiplayer beta because I had like a launch retail copy of Wolfenstein the New Order that there's a little fucking sticker on that box that says multiplayer beta access for like the new Doom game. They still haven't fucking done it. I want like... It's almost like I don't fucking give a shit if the game is good or not. I just want it to be made right. I just want the promises made to me, I want them to be fulfilled, okay? Like, what the fuck? Just, like, it's a multiplayer beta. Everyone does it. Just fucking do it. It's not a big deal. That game's probably going to be fine. I don't have a huge amount of faith in it. A game that I am tremendously curious about that I'm never going to play, but Fable Legends, the new... entry in the like very misused Fable franchise, a franchise that has two really great like RPGs in Fable 1 and Fable 2, a terrible one in Fable 3, and just has like they've like Microsoft has not done anything notable with that franchise since Fable 3.
Oh, I did a Kinect game, Fable.
Yeah,
The Journey.
You remembered the name of that game. That's fucking amazing, Jonathan.
I don't know how I did it.
I couldn't remember it.
I started that sentence, and I don't know where this is going.
Like,
Jonathan, you don't remember the name of that game, and then it came back from the ether, Fable the Journey.
Do you know why I phrased that sentence that they haven't done anything noticeable with it since Fable 3? Do you know why I said it like that? Because I couldn't remember the name of that fucking game, so I'm very glad that you're here. The person who's never played a Fable game before.
Nope.
To remember the name of the fucking Kinect version. Yeah, so... But that trend of not being able to remember that Fable games exist will probably continue with Fable Legends. That game does not look interesting to me in the slightest. And every time there has been a demo of it at E3s... Because this is another one that they had at the unveiling of the console for Xbox One. I just get depressed looking at that game because it's like... Fable 2 in particular was really good. I think it's probably a game that would be hard to go back to. When it came out, I loved that game so much. It did so many things that were so interesting and really like off the wall game design that other games just never did. In terms of how like he had like very minimalistic inventory and like UI stuff that they sort of played around with, that was really cool. That other games just sort of make a very standard user interface and don't think about how players interact with it. And Fable 2, like, reimagines some of those things that other studios have not really picked up on. And so to see, like, that franchise that had a really fascinating, unique entry like that, just, like, go the way of Kinect versions and weird multiplayer spinoffs, that's just sad. That's a depressing thing. That should be happening. I don't know what they're doing with that franchise. And then moving on, let's see, we talked about Halo Wars 2. Horizon Zero Dawn, that's another PS4 thing that might come out this year. It doesn't have like any sort of defined, even like quarterly projected release date. But that's Horizon Zero Dawn is the PS4 exclusive that's about like neo cavemen shooting robot dinosaurs with giant bows and stuff.
That game, right.
that game looks like it's going to be really fucking good. Again, I have no idea if it's actually going to come out this year, but that was the sort of, like, suggested thing of, like, it's coming soon, 2016, maybe, hopefully. So I have every faith that that game is going to be really good. They're making that new Nier game. That's still happening. That weird, like, JRPG franchise that has a really rabid fan base that I don't know what that game really is. They're making a game that I have no idea what this is, but I just saw it called Overkill's The Walking Dead, which apparently is a different... It's because you have the Telltale Walking Dead games that people really love. Then you had that one weird one that Activision sort of just shit out that was like a first-person shooter based on the TV show. This appears to be a third completely different game based on the Walking Dead franchise made by the people who made that Payday game that's like that heist multiplayer game. I've never heard of this. I have no idea what it is. It's probably going to be terrible. I just saw it and was like, that's really weird that they're making another Walking Dead game. But that's happening. Then, let's see, I think there was a couple of other things. Oh, Rise of the Tomb Raider is coming out for PC, I think, in February, and then PS4 sometime in quarter four, so in the holiday season.
Maybe someone will finally buy and play it.
Yeah, like, I definitely will. That was one of my games I should really get around to playing thing, so I want to do that. Sea of Thieves is the new Rare game that Microsoft is publishing for Xbox One that I have, again, it's just one of these, like, a bunch of these are just games that were sort of briefly shown at the last E3 and have never been talked about since. The Sea of Thieves is probably going to be interesting. Like, I have no idea what that game is, but hey, Rare is making video games again. Apparently they're making another Sonic Boom game, Sonic Boom Fire and Ice, and I get to look at that and just be sad again because somehow, like, they made the original Sonic the Hedgehog games are amazing, and then you get into the adventure games and they're like okay but uneven, and then you get past that and it's like you just get this raw fucking just unfiltered bullshit just shitty ass fucking Sonic games, and then this shining golden moment of just like Nirvana that was Sonic Generations, like this incredible thing. You have no idea how that game was made because it feels like it came out of nowhere. It's an incredible Sonic game. And then they just start making these Sonic Boom games, and they're making another one. Even though the Sonic Boom game that came out last year was, like, one of the most, like, poorly reviewed games that came out that entire fucking year. Just, what are you doing with Sonic the Hedgehog? Why?
It speaks to how good the original Sonic games are that this is not one of the most reviled franchises of all time.
Yeah, like, it's so hard to keep hope. It's so hard to, like, hold on to that. It's so hard to just be, like... to say that I am a fan of Sonic the Hedgehog in any capacity, because it's been so long. It's like, you just had Sonic Generations was so fucking good. I don't understand how they just never, it never occurred to them to build off of that sort of foundation and make a new game.
And that
game.
Was a long time ago now. That was like, 2011.
Yeah, that was a long fucking time ago. That was when we were freshmen. Yes. Was when that game came out. God, we fucking graduated. We've, like, went through our entire college careers.
Without another
good Sonic game. That's so depressing. Then, okay, moving on from that. The Tacoma game, that's the next game from Fulbright, the people who made Gone Home, that's coming out this year. That's I'm sure that's going to be great. Apparently, Wikipedia claims that The Legend of Zelda...
I've got
game.
That.
Okay, you got... Okay, we'll talk about that. And I think that about sums up the other things I was looking at.
All so, right. Yeah. And the final unscheduled we have to talk about.
Yeah.
Persona 5. Motherfucker, Persona 5.
Yep.
I will just say, let's think about this. Look at the number of potentially all-time great games that are coming out this year.
Mm-hmm.
If you just think about, like, Fire Emblem Fates and Uncharted 4 and No Man's Sky and Final Fantasy 15 and Mass Effect Andromeda and then Persona 5 as, like, the top of the pyramid.
Yeah.
Man, I mean, we have talked about it many times before, but, oh man, Persona 5. Have you ever been more excited for anything?
Jonathan, every single trailer for the Persona 5 has been better than most games I've ever played.
Yes.
It's like, and like, especially that, like, that one, the first one that had the new theme song on it, like, that trailer is so amazing. Like, holy shit.
I mean, we have said this before. There is a very real possibility, and we could not say this in most years, that we could come out of 2016, both of us, with a new favorite game ever.
Yeah.
It could be, because my number one and two, Persona 3, Persona 4, I think you'd probably agree.
Yes, absolutely.
So, hey, if Persona 5 is better than one of those, and it totally could be, it might not be, and even if it's not, whatever, it's going to be up there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, at the very least, our top five might be changing. I mean, that, yeah, I could not... be more excited if I wanted to be. And I'm kind of like just trying not to think about it.
Yeah.
Because who knows when we'll actually get it over here. But
it is, because it's almost surreal. Like, because it is such a
monumental thing.
Yeah. God damn.
Because we didn't experience 3 and 4 when they came out.
Yeah, no.
But 5 we are. And it feels like we've been on the hype train for a while, because you've been playing the arena games. I played Persona Q. We both played Dancing All Night.
I've been dancing ever since.
We've been watching the anime. We've been following the movies. And now we have a new Persona game. And if you don't follow Persona, it's a big deal, because this isn't just another spin-off of 3 or 4. This is an actual numbered entry, which means...
like, new characters, new setting, new themes.
New story.
Yeah.
It's a totally different world. It's almost like it's no new sub-franchise.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and made by the same people who did 3 and 4. Yeah. God damn.
I mean, it's like, because those Persona, like, Persona 3 and 4 are so good. They, like, practically changed our podcast.
Yes.
Because of, like, how much it influenced us and what we were doing. That's, like, when that hit, it hit so fucking hard.
Oh, I said this at the time. Persona 3 changed my life.
Yeah.
And I've talked about that before. You can go hear me fucking crying on the podcast talking about Persona 3. Whatever. I own it. Persona 3, just life-changing. And Persona 4, to a similar extent. So.
Yeah.
I may even have to... I've played Persona 3 twice. I have not done my replay of Persona 4. I might have to do that this year. I might just... because you can get them for, like, a nickel now, I might have to get a PlayStation
TV. I feel
TV
like those... like, and every time that Sony has, like, a game sale, I feel like all the Persona games are always on sale.
I was going to say, I was going to maybe get a PlayStation TV, the Vita TV, because you can get those for, like, a nickel now.
Yeah.
And play Persona 4
I think
4
they'll
that
pay you to get one of those.
No, but you're right. I mean, they have that. They had that game sale going on this week, and you could get Persona 4 the Golden for $9.
Yeah, God, that's...
that is it's just incredible. I mean, there's no price that is too much for Persona 4 Golden. Yeah. I fucking bought a Vita for it, but yeah.
So did I. Like, I literally did. Like, yeah. I saw you playing that game. I was like, this is crazy. Like, I finished playing Persona 4 less than a year ago, and then I... fucking bought a Vita.
I know this isn't how it literally happened, Sean, but here's how I remember it. I remember sitting on the couch and you coming up and being like, oh, you're playing it? Oh, I want to see this. And so you kind of watched me play it for a while and you're like, those crows are new. And then I remember you walking out of the room, and in my mind, you went up to your computer, ordered a Vita, and then came back down to keep watching me play.
I mean, that's practically how, like, that's almost not even exaggerated. It was not, it was that night, but I specifically remember that time when you were on the couch playing the game, and it was like, well, let me have a look at it, I want to see. And it was like, I came behind you, and you, like, you were walking to school in the morning, and there was a scene with, like, I think it was, like, the acting school girl or something, like, before you had met her, or the acting club girl, and it was like... oh, they never put that in the original game. Like, that's like they're introducing... oh, and look, there's, like, that character walking in the background who's not even a part of the game yet. It's like, this scene wasn't in the original game. It's like, yeah, it was like, oh my god, you get to walk around that night. And listen, that's a different song. And it was like, this is, like, listing off every single change they had made. Because Persona 4 was so fresh in my mind. And I was like, fuck, I have to buy this goddamn game and this console right now. What the fuck?
That's the other thing I want to say about the PlayStation TV, which is that set-top box that plays Vita games. If you want to play Persona 4 Golden but don't want to buy a whole system, the PS TV is like $30.
Yeah.
Get that, get Persona 4 Golden for like $10, and there you go. You're not even paying a full $60 for it. You just have to have a DualShock 3 or 4.
And I think the PS TV comes with a DualShock 3.
Certain versions.
Okay.
Yeah.
You clearly have looked into this more than I have.
Yeah. No, it's there are two versions, basically. But yeah, I might have to go in at some point just in case I want to play Persona 4 again. Maybe play it on the TV. Who knows? Could be fun. Yeah, or what you said you would do, where every time you go into the TV world, put the PS TV on.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be fun. Anyway, Persona 5. All right, and finally, my last category of the evening, who the fuck knows?
Okay, yeah.
Led by Zelda for Wii U.
That's not coming out this year.
Here's the problem. People keep saying Zelda for Wii U emphatically, like that's going to exist. You guys are also reporting that the NX is coming out this year. Do you really think it's coming out for the Wii U? I understand that it could. I also understand it would be stupid of them if it did. So, here's the thing. One of these two is happening this year. Either Zelda is coming out for Wii U this year, or the NX is coming out this year, but both are not happening. I just don't see how that's a possibility.
Yeah, no. I mean, because if it's something where, like, I just don't see this game coming out this year. I mean, for God's sakes, we don't even know what the title of the fucking game is.
Yeah.
Like, people just have to call it The Legend of Zelda game for the Wii U.
It doesn't still even have key art yet.
Yeah, like, we had no... like, we know almost nothing about this game. We've seen, like, one trailer and like one gameplay demo, basically, is all they've released about this game.
Yeah.
And that was like, that was a while ago because they didn't talk about it at E3 at all.
No, and it sounds like there have been some changes in development, not bad, but just deciding to expand it. So it's been a while since they showed it off. And yeah, I mean, it just, it flabbergasted me when like, so going back to the Amazon thing, yeah. not as a sales pitch, but when they did that, everyone like Kotaku, IGN, Polygon, when they announced that Amazon new Prime perk, they listed a couple games you could get with it, and every one of those lists had Zelda for Wii U, and it's like, why would you pre-order that? That version that you're pre-ordering literally might not exist.
Yeah.
The Wii U version, I promise you, it could, but you have to think about this logically. It just might not exist. I think the game exists. It'll come out for something. But saying it'll come out for Wii U in 2016, that's the most unsure thing on this list. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
If it does, I mean, I'm sure it'll be good. All that stuff. I'm not being cynical about the quality of the game. But its existence in 2016 on Wii U, you're gambling if you're thinking that.
Yeah. Again, we don't even know what the title of the game is.
Yeah.
It might not even be called Legend of Zelda anymore. They might have just said, like, no, we're just going to, like, not put that in the title of these games.
The Legend of Linkle.
Yeah. It could. Hey, oh, that was actually a game we missed. That game's coming out this year.
Hyrule Warrior Legends?
Yes, for the 3DS, yeah. So if this will be the year of Linkle.
Yes.
We had the year of Luigi a while ago. It's time to bring back that marketing campaign. Year of Linkle. Hashtag.
All right. Then also under Who the Fuck Knows is there are reports that Assassin's Creed might take a year off.
Yeah.
Now, I think would both be in agreement that that would be a good idea.
Yes.
And do you think it's likely?
I think, yeah. I think that maybe, like, because, well, Syndicate has, like, gotten good reviews and good buzz and stuff. Like, Unity was rough. Assassin's Creed 3 was rough. Assassin's Creed 2 Revelations was rough. Like, the Assassin's Creed franchise is really up and down. And I feel like if they just, like, pulled back from the yearly release thing and just said, like, every other year or every 3 years... I think they would make that the quality of those games a lot more stable, and they could make more changes to those games and make them more exciting and fresh and interesting. Because even though I do think Assassin's Creed Syndicate is a good game, it's a very bland game to me. Like, after having put a lot of time into it, it feels stale because it feels like it goes back to like basically the same model that Assassin's Creed 2 was built on, and like has like some of that gang stuff is different, but it feels like. As well, Assassin's Creed 4, the Black Flag, like, definitely pushed things in a really fascinating direction with the ship combat that, like, really made that feel fresh. The gang stuff is not enough to make Syndicate feel that different from how the Assassin's Creed 2 games were. And it's like that franchise needs to evolve. And they still have not gotten a handle on how the fuck to make, like, the story stuff in these games anymore. Because they've half abandoned the modern-day storyline, but they haven't totally abandoned it yet in a way that just feels sort of desperate. Because it feels like they really want that connective tissue that the modern-day storyline stuff provides for Assassin's Creed. But they killed off the main character back, like, fucking 4 games or something ago, back in Assassin's Creed 3. And they haven't replaced Desmond since then. So, like, it just feels like they don't understand what they're doing with Assassin's Creed. So I would not be surprised if Ubisoft recognized that and decided to back off and take a break and, like make some breathing room and figure out what they want Assassin's Creed to be.
Yeah. Now, the reports are that if they do that, maybe we get an HD collection this year. Not HD, but, like, remastered collection.
Yeah, for, like, the Assassin's Creed 2 stuff.
That doesn't quite make sense. I just don't... Yeah, I guess they could do the 2 trilogy. But at the same time, it's like, would anyone even want to play those games now?
I mean, I wouldn't want to. I think those games would be hard to replay, but I think, like, we're getting so many of those sort of, like, you know, like, the Master Chief Collection, the Nathan Drake Trek Collection, why not the Ezio Auditore da Firenze Collection?
If they actually called it that, the whole thing, that'd be awesome.
Like, I would not want it. I would not recommend it to people because I just, again, like, I mean, the only one of those games that I really love is Assassin's Creed 2 because Brotherhood and Revelations are so just more Assassin's Creed 2 that it was hard to get into them. So I would not recommend it to people, but I would see from, like, Ubisoft's perspective, I don't see the reason not to do that.
Yeah.
Like, I can't imagine it takes a lot of, like, man hours and resources to put one of those games, like, one of those collections out compared to, obviously, like, making a new Assassin's Creed.
Right. All right, the other question, new Call of Duty... We'll probably get it.
Almost without a doubt. Like, but Infinity Ward's year.
Right. It's Infinity Ward's year, and here's my big question mark. Do they do Ghost 2, or do they start fresh?
It's an interesting question because it felt like Ghosts was...
That's the biggest miss Call of Duty has ever had.
Like, nobody likes Call of Duty Ghosts. Like, some people think it's okay, but, like, the Call of Duty fan base did not gravitate toward that game at all.
It didn't sell well. It wasn't well received. It's the biggest miss.
Yeah, the critics
miss.
Didn't like it.
But the biggest miss they've ever had.
Yeah, easily. And, yeah, it's something where...
Do they go and do Modern Warfare?
That'd be great if they called it that.
Yeah.
They would never call it that.
Or, I mean, that would be the obvious angle, but it would be... I would laugh so hard if they came out later this year and said, we're doing Ghost 2.
Yeah.
And tried to build hype around that.
Then, like, showed more, like, video footage of, like, mo-capping dogs and stuff. Because that was the only thing that was cool about Ghosts, was that, like, when they announced that there was that cool video where they're, like, mo-capping a dog.
Yes.
And it was like, he was jumping on a dude. It's like, yeah, that dog looks awesome in that suit. But yeah,
funny.
Like, I'm really curious about what Infinity Ward is going to do. It's like, Call of Duty, I feel like I have such a strange relationship towards the Call of Duty franchise now. Because it used to be the thing that I was like, I really love Call of Duty 2. I love Modern Warfare. I liked a lot about Modern Warfare 2, but it completely burned me out on the franchise. And I just backed off and didn't play it for years. And I played Advanced Warfare. I still fucking love that game. Advanced Warfare is great. The multiplayer in that game is so much fun. And then I played the beta for Black Ops 3. Didn't give a shit. Then it's like, it was like, it's okay. It's nowhere near as much fun as that Advanced Warfare stuff. And so it's like, I don't know if like my relationship towards that franchise I feel is very unstable at the moment.
Well, because it's three different franchises.
Yeah,
right now,
it was like, I used to feel so confident in my, like, I'm just a lapsed fan of this series. It was like part of my identity is I like those old Call of Duty games and I've walked away from it and I've never really looked back. And then it was like, but Advanced Warfare is so good, and it just so doesn't feel like a Call of Duty game to me. Like, it feels like it's very similar, but it feels like it's different enough that it was like could have very easily just been a completely different franchise, you know? And then, yeah, now with the three studio system and the three studios feeling like they have such distinct visions for what Call of Duty is, because the Black Ops 3 movement stuff is completely different than the Advanced Warfare stuff. Like, there's no similarities to it whatsoever. And so, like, it's those games play very differently from my perspective, at the very least. And so, it's a weird thing that I don't understand who's out there buying every single year's Call of Duty game. Because even if you're just a casual fan who's not, like, invested in the studio side of it, like, you have to at least recognize at some point that's, like, Black Ops and Modern Warfare, and then Black Ops 2, and then Ghosts and Advanced Warfare, and then Black Ops 3. Like, those are all very different games that, like, feel like they come from different lineages, because Treyarch feels like it has a unique studio identity now. Infinity Ward feels like it lost its studio identity after 2, and then now you have Sledgehammer that feels like it's this new creative voice in that franchise. And all of them, like, and it feels like none of them bleed over. Like, there's nothing about Advanced Warfare that feels like it is a part of what I played in Black Ops 3. Even though they're both, like, future warfare stuff with, like, exosuits, like, nothing about how those exosuits factor into the gameplay feels like it's shared whatsoever. It's bizarre.
Very bizarre. So, that's Call of Duty. I hope the next game is Ghost 2 and the cover is a dude holding a white flag.
I hope the next one is, like, Call of Duty Advanced Black Ops, and it's just like a picture of like whoever the studio head is for Infinity Ward flipping like double birds. It's like, we fucking made Call of Duty. I mean, not me, not us personally, because all those people got fired like years ago, but like our studio made Call of Duty. Fuck you guys. It's like, it must be so weird working for Infinity Ward and being like, we used to be the guys that like every other year, like they called the Treyarch like the off year studio. It's like, now we're, like, the off-off-year studio. Like, there's two studios that make better Call of Duty games than us now. What the fuck? That's gotta be, like, such a strange feeling.
All right. And finally, I'm just putting it out here because who the fuck knows? That's the title of this category. Kingdom Hearts 3.
No.
No way it comes out this year.
No.
But why do they keep showing fucking footage for it? It's like, stop it. If obviously this game isn't anywhere near... They haven't even put it in the oven yet. It's not even half-baked.
No. Jonathan, they need to at least give people time to play all the way through Kingdom Hearts HD 2.8 Final Chapter Prologue. The prologue to the final chapter.
I just love, if you look at the last trailer that came out for Kingdom Hearts 3, it says, currently in development. Instead of coming soon, it says, currently in development.
It should just be like, this might come out.
Like, I mean... this could honestly be this generation's The Last Guardian, and that they announced at the beginning, and they were so cocky it's just going to take like 10 years for it to come out.
But the funny thing is that it would be both this generation's The Last Guardian and last generation's The Last Guardian.
Good point, yeah.
Because like Kingdom Hearts 3 has been teased since Kingdom Hearts 2, which was a PS2 game.
Yeah, 2005. I mean, the people who played Kingdom Hearts 2 were all kids, and they're all grown up now.
Yeah.
And that's either going to be a huge nostalgia boon, or it's going to be a wasteland, and I don't know which one. But it's like, you know, my little brother was big into Kingdom Hearts 2. He is 20. He was 10 when he played that. I mean, we're talking, it's nuts. You know? Yeah. It's nuts.
But now you have, like, you can put all the characters from Frozen and Wreck-It
Ralph.
Star Wars
and Marvel, if you want.
Oh, God.
I don't think they will,
yeah,
but...
Yeah, no. That would be insane.
I've always wanted to see Sora and Tony Stark.
Just that sentence, just putting those two names together and thinking about those characters. I'm just like imagining like Robert Downey Jr. standing next to like the Who Framed Roger Rabbit, like Sora, like animated. They should make a Kingdom Hearts movie. Like that should be the next step. The Kingdom Hearts movie that never comes out.
Once or Daffy Duck and Thor. Something like that? Yeah. Daffy Duck and Thor would be great. Donald Duck and Thor. Anyway. All right. It's getting late. So that is 2016 in gaming. There are other things that could come out, but we don't know about them. So who knows?
I mean, here's one thing we should, like, let's end this with. I think this is something that's a really big speculative point that is like a potential sea shift and sea change for the entire, like, medium is VR coming out. Because the Oculus Rift is coming out March 28th. If you have a like $1,000 PC and $600 to buy this headset, then you can start playing VR games.
I don't care.
Yeah.
My position has not changed. VR, don't give a shit. But they're putting a lot of money into it and whatever. So
I mean, it's something where like it feels like this has been on the horizon for a long time. And Oculus with Facebook is in the game. Valve is in the game with their Vive thing that got pushed back. And then Sony's in the game with PSVR. It feels like... It's interesting. Like, it's interesting, and it's also, I feel like, for some people, that they've realized, oh, also, it's fucking expensive. And, yes. Like, I'm really curious, particularly, what the price point for the PSVR is, because if I'm going to get any of these headsets, like, that's the only one that's even plausible.
Yeah, me
like,
too. Yeah.
The Oculus Rift is so insanely expensive, not just because of the price point on the headset itself, but, like, the barrier to entry to get it for the PC you need is insane. It's so expensive to make a PC that's to that... what they like say is their minimum system prerequisites.
Yeah,
but like it's going to be fascinating. Like even if it's something that we're not going to be able to participate in right away, and like most people aren't going to be able to participate in it right away, it's the most exciting sort of technical side to video game development that's come along in a very long time. Like because this feels like it could be legitimate. Like it could. This to me feels like it's. A lot more than the Kinect. It's a lot more than even like the Wiimote, which had its like time of the spotlight but died out very quickly. Like if VR works, like VR could be here not just for like video games, but for like much broader societal applications that shall hasten us towards our dark cyberpunk dystopia that we all know is coming around the horizon.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, let's check back in 10 years. I still think this is in such infancy, just in terms of how much penetration it even could have, that we'll see. But, you know, it's what games are going to be developed for Oculus that could really make an impact when the barrier to entry, as you say, is so absurdly high?
Yeah.
I do think PlayStation VR is the area where it could make an impact because the PS4 has the penetration it has, and Sony, they actually know how to develop and sell a game console.
Yeah.
You know, that's the basic thing. But whether it'll work or not, who knows? So,
but it's just something where like Oculus Rift will be the first one like commercially available. Like this will be like there's a lot of other versions of this product that are still in development and are like on the horizon. But it's like 2016 will be the year when it's like it's time to like put this to the test. It's like it's time to see if this is something that the broader market can be interested in. Like obviously, like. No matter what, it's going to take a long time because it's going to take a long time for the technology to get cheap enough for it to be available to a wider audience and for them to to find some way to unshackle themselves from the PC, which I think is going to be like really necessary for this to get a like broader societal acceptance. But it's something we need to talk about because
it's
coming.
VR gave us that wonderful Time magazine meme of the really nerdy guy jumping with his VR headset. I love that picture, and whenever it crops up in funny Photoshops. Yeah.
And we just are going to get treated to years and years now of people desperately trying to fucking figure out how to make commercials for VR in the way that, like, old commercials for Kinect games are the most hilarious things in the world. Like, yes. If you want to have a good, like, 10 minutes, go onto YouTube and just, like, look at Kinect commercials from, like, 2008. They are fucking astoundingly hilarious. I'm just looking forward to all, like, the weird, like, Iron Man in the mask shots that people are going to copy for their VR commercials.
Yeah. I also think one of the questions of 2016 is how the console market is going to shake out.
Yeah.
Because it's a weird thing where the Xbox One is by no means doing poorly, but it is lagging so far behind the PS4.
Yeah.
It's the kind of gap that even in the days of like the PS2, it almost feels different than that.
Yeah.
Of,
because with the PS2, like the PS2 was not like, I feel like not like that astronomically ahead of like the GameCube and the Xbox. I mean, the Xbox was like, was weird because it came in late, but.
Right. It came in late. It was a new one. GameCube was on its own island kind of. But yeah, the PS4 just, it's getting to the point where it's not even a competition, and I wonder what path Xbox winds up taking. If they just stay the course, or if that even is viable. I wonder how much stuff is going to wind up being dominant with the PS4 this year.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the NX does come out this year, what that shifts in things. I don't think the PS4 is going anywhere, but if the NX seriously challenges the Xbox One, then we have a rodeo on our hands.
Yeah. I mean, it's also something like on that same note, like obviously this is like the NX is kind of around the corner at some point, but like I just out of curiosity on this Wikipedia list of 2016 in video gaming, I just control F to Wii U as they have it like listed in their like systems thing, and I got 13 results.
So, not a lot, huh?
Yeah, like right now there's projected 13 Wii U games. I'm just going to, this is going to be a very high number. I just want to see for PS4, I get 176 responses on PS4. How do they even do the Xbox
One? XBO.
XBO?
Yeah.
XBO gets 129, which is very high. I'm not even going to try like PC because that's just going to be really high. And then 3DS, like 3DS has 23.
Which is a fair number for a portable.
Yeah.
Yeah, 13 for the Wii. I mean, the Wii U, it's weird. I think the biggest sign that the NX is coming this year is that the Wii U games are pretty much all clustered from February to April.
Yeah.
So,
and then obviously, like, the games we've talked about here are not comprehensive, and we do not know every game that's going to come out this year. That, like, there are always, like, late announces and releases that still come out in that year that we just don't know about. So this is not, like, everything, but it is a good snapshot of, like, yeah, the Wii U's feels like it is really winding down.
Yeah, it's been a weird, sad path. But anyway, they just released Metroid Zero Mission on the Virtual Console, and I bought it, and I can't wait to get the chance to play it. Because that fucking game, I've always wanted to play it. It's one of those Game Boy Advance games that costs like $80 on eBay. And it came out in Japan on their Virtual Console like a year and a half ago. It came out in Europe the next month. And then we've been waiting for North America for like a year. We finally get it. I haven't had time to play it yet, but I've bought it. It's on my console. I'm so happy to have it. It's Zero Mission is the remake of the original Metroid, but like much bigger.
Yeah.
Can't wait to play it. I'm sure it's fantastic. I don't know why it took them so long to get the exact same thing out here. What the hell, Nintendo?
Do you know what's great about that? I used to have that game back on my Game Boy Advance a long time ago, but like the case that I had that had my games in it was stolen one time when one of my brother's basketball games, I think it was.
Yeah, I never had it.
It's one of the few like Metroid games that I played a long time ago, and I remember liking it, but I don't remember much.
It's
about
a fan
it.
Favorite, and I even considered, because I have my Game Boy Advance, it's in perfect working order, but it is really expensive on eBay, so I've never gotten it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, I think that wraps it up for this week. Next week, I'm not sure what the show will be. Depending on whether or not it gets here, we might be talking about the next Persona 3 movie.
Oh, fuck. We great. Might. Yeah.
Yeah. Happy early birthday, Sean.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's, or late. It's very early or like very late, depending on how you look at it. But yeah.
Anyway, so yes, that'll be next week or something else.
Definitely we'll figure it out.
Interesting 2016.
More Witcher 3 to come. I'm excited about that. Hear your progress through that game.